Shine Down, our brand new number one song. That's it for us. If you miss any part of our chart, you can find it at thesideshowcountdown.com.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
And I'm Nikki Sixx, and we'll see you on tour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Hi, Jolene.
Hello, Peter.
Well, it's kind of hard not on a talk show that WRIF has set up for all of you listeners to call into, not to talk about the theater massacre.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that. Everything that I did this weekend that was just fun, going to to a show, a rock show, going, you know, going swimming.
Going here, going there.
Going there. That's what, you know, we're not in Aurora, Colorado. Actually, a friend of mine who, well, you know her, you saw her. Did I tell you that? That her daughter, you know, the woman that was at my house?
Yeah.
Her daughter was supposed to go to the opening. She was in Aurora, you know.
Right there. Oh, yeah. Gosh. Yeah. That is just startling.
And, you know, in some ways, I was kind of searching around for something different to say, something new, some way to frame what's happening in our country. That it's just, you know, Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T, has a book called Armed Madhouse.
Yeah, and we are one.
Yeah, and yet, you know, I was thinking, well, one of the things I was thinking, the first I heard of it, I went to the Detroit News online, and it was this, you know, horrific description of this the slaughter of these innocents. And
tough to read.
Very tough to read. And then I thought, well, I'll see what the comments are. And the comments were from all these guys saying, if everybody would have been armed, you know.
Then everyone could have just shot each other.
What was a six-year-old doing there? You know, what? I mean, there wasn't a hint of compassion. These liberals.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, isn't there any one of these guys that's fighting back tears?
Yeah, and thinking about all those lives lost and all the people injured and all the families who are affected by this.
I don't know what to say, actually. But I mean, they start just reading this little bit of this piece from Yahoo News, actually from ABC News, published in Yahoo. It says, gun deaths, a familiar American experience. And all you got to do if you pay the slightest bit of attention to know there's a mass murder a week in this country.
Yep.
And most of us either, well, it doesn't affect us directly. In fact, I'm wondering how many of you, if you don't, you're not in the biz, so maybe you don't see the kind of sources that Jolene and I do. You know, we're looking at stuff all over the country. We're looking at summaries.
World.
We're getting, you know, emails from different, news sites telling us what's going on. But, you know, there's mass murders every single day in every week, rather, in this country. And, I mean, we hear about Mexico. And I'd be curious to see what the comparison is. I think Mexico may still be in the lead of the U.S., but certainly, let me see, among the world's 23 wealthiest countries, 80% of all gun deaths are American deaths, and 80% of all kids killed by guns are American kids in the world. In the 23 wealthiest countries. The Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery found that the gun murder rate in the U.S. is almost 20 times higher than the next 22 richest nations combined.
Oh, my gosh.
So something's dreadfully wrong here, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, it really does have to do with the gun laws, not to get y'all riled up and take your guns away, but why did this guy have an assault rifle? Why did he have this AR-15? Why does anybody have an assault rifle?
Or a 40 caliber Glock pistol, two of them with these extended magazines.
Yeah.
This is not, if you're interested in home defense or personal defense, this is not exactly the weapon that you need. But let's go look at numbers a little. By the way, if you want to jump in on this, our number is 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
So you got all these guys coming out of the woodwork. If everybody would have had a gun in the theater, that would have ended it really quickly. Well, if five people in that theater would have had guns. And by the way, it was an AMC theater that that prohibited the carrying guns into the theater. In Colorado, you can take a concealed weapon into any establishment unless the the owner says you can't.
Is that including bars?
I don't know. Okay. I don't even want to think about
it. Yeah, I know.
But the argument is, the more guns argument is that if a few people would have had guns, it would have ended the threat real quickly. Well, first off, all of a sudden, a bunch of people shooting in a theater. I mean, there's a couple of ways. It's possible that that could have been the case.
That they could have gotten the guy.
Yeah, that's very possible that all of a sudden some very alert person that had violated the MC policy had a gun and got off a lucky shot. Because remember, this guy was all armored. He had bought also commercially all this body armor, throat army, armor, groin army, armor.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people dress up for these movies. And
So it's possible that that it could have been ended like that. I mean, that, I don't think that's even the question. Probably not. And if you had several people shooting, and I don't know. I mean, even though people have to go through training and all that, do we really want to depend on people in a crowd shooting? I mean, it's better than, you could argue it's better than what happened. But
it's like the Wild West. I mean, give me a break.
Here's the problem with the more guns argument. There's about 300 million guns in the United States.
Really?
One for every person, almost.
Mm-hmm.
About 40% of families have guns in their house. A lot of it is concentrated, and people have 6, 8, 10 guns. A lot of gun owners are apt to own more than one gun.
Yeah, there's collectors, right?
No, I mean, yeah, whatever they use them for hunting, for home defense. They just like to have those deadly little machines around.
Yeah,
right?
They do. And it's been suggested to me in the past by people that I should have one in my house, and there is no way in hell there's going to be a gun in my house. And I know you have a gun.
Yeah, but people don't know whether it's in my attic in a gun bag or whether I got this cold steel pressing on my bare flesh under my shirt.
Yeah, here at the studio.
Yeah, right. But in any event, so let's talk about adults. So say you have 200 million adults, and they have between them 300 million guns, mm-hmm. right? And let's say that 1% of all those people have the capacity to commit acts that we, not that are on this scale, but, you know, that act out and wind up killing their, you know, their ex, their estranged wife and her family,
yeah.
or, you know, all that stuff. That's, what is that, you know, 10% would be, what, 10 million? So that's 2 million people running around our country. Not all of them are going to do it. Obviously, we're not having 2 million people creating mass murders. But if you start getting it really thinly, you know, sort of surgically carved down, maybe there's like 0.5% or 0.01% mm-hmm. to do that. But this is enough to create this society that's the deadliest first world country in the world.
It's the same kind of numbers with terrorism, you know, where everyone, you know, all the anti-Muslim sentiment, it's like that 0.00001 of that population are the ones who, you know, do these acts, commit these acts.
Well, you know, so also, so what I often say about crime in a neighborhood, even in the poorest neighborhoods, crime is probably committed by, you know, 2-3% of the people. But that's enough to make it hell for everybody, because probably in our neighborhood there's like next to nobody doing it, right?
Right.
Okay, but the point
being, although there was an assault rifle used 2 weeks ago at the 7-Eleven down the street.
And is that right?
Yeah, yeah. It was the same gun. The AK-47.
AR-15.
But I think they had
an AK.
Yeah,
wow.
They had an AK-47. And the police said that it was during the power outage that we had. And the police said if those doors hadn't been locked, that these guys were going in. And they said anyone who has that kind of a gun is carrying it around and going in to rob a place has all intentions of killing.
Sure. Yeah. But the problem with the more guns argument, that everybody should have a gun, and I saw these guys on television, well, if everybody was armed, then you increase the number of people that have the potential for doing, mischief, certainly understates it,
yeah.
Committing horrific acts. So if you have more and more people with more and more guns, it's just going to up the level of violence. And I think I've said before, if you read the NRA's magazine, The Rifleman, you see every issue it's got, oh, you know, grandma pulled a gun on an intruder or, you know, what have you. And
well, there are some cases where it does help.
But I don't think anybody can deny that the overall effect of guns used, even outside of war, for, you know, think about war, but outside of war, that more people have been injured and killed than anywhere near the people that have been saved. And there's something like in this article here, it says, according to the Children's Defense Fund, in the 44 years since Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King were shot to death, bullets have ended the lives of more than 1 million people in the United States.
My gosh, that's incredible.
So, well, and by the way, now still that people, I think it's the majority of people, where is this in here? Oh, yeah. But regardless, polls show that public attitudes don't change even after a mass slaughter like this. 49% of the people say it's more important to protect gun rights, while 45% favor tighter gun control. Well, there was, you know, that the importation of assault rifles was prohibited. But why these things are even allowed to be in civilian hands is way beyond me. I mean, some people say, well, you know, in case the government gets tyrannical, you know, we'll, you know, I'll have my AR-15. Well, I'll tell you, pal, against the 82nd Airborne, you don't have much of a chance.
Well, and, you know, the forefathers in the Constitution, the gun ownership was based upon an organized militia.
Now, you know what? It was, and that's what it seems to make sense, but the Supreme Court has...
but that's what their intent was, is what I'm saying.
Well, here, this is, all right, well, wait a minute here. So, anyway, this says 60% say enforce existing laws. But this is pretty interesting. Here, this is a gun supporter, Eugene Bullock, an expert in constitutional law at the University of California at Los Angeles. He says the guy basically, get this, the guy basically had normal guns. A 40 caliber, a 40, two 40 caliber Glock pistols with extended magazines, AR-15s with a, what do you call that? A drum magazine that could hold 100 shots.
And he had the 12-gauge.
And a 12-gauge shotgun.
That's a normal gun.
Yeah, but I mean, come on. I mean, this is what, so this is guy's a gun nut, but okay, let's go with him, all right? He says, unless some new evidence of documented psychiatric disturbances emerge, Mr. Volok added, there is no indication that from his record he is someone whom more restrictive screening procedures would have caught. Now, doesn't this argue absolutely against the idea that the laws have to remain the same?
Yeah.
Because they're saying you couldn't have caught the guy. And by the way, I'm not even necessarily calling for anything because I don't know what to do. You got 300 million guns out there, and there's no way to bring them back unless you have like some huge magnet.
Yeah, and those are the legal ones.
Yeah. So what I wanted to suggest, and in all this, is that if you've got if you think we ought to just leave everything as they are, I mean, how do we stop all this? Or is it just go with the territory? Or why is this country have such a streak of madness in it?
For someone who was seemingly just kind of a quiet intellectual. I mean, the guy was going for his PhD at one point in neuroscience.
Did you see the video of him at this college seminar?
No.
Oh, he was just
normal,
sweetest kid in the world talking about video games.
And usually you picture someone who would go to these lengths and kill all of these people as someone who would look a little crazier.
Yeah. Mr. Volok, the arms expert, said the fragmentary information available so far about Mr. Holmes and the attack, he says, does not make a strong case for reform. He said the only weapons control solution that could do anything about this kind of murder would be a total ban on guns.
Oh, my.
And he said...
Now you're going to get him going.
Well, he doesn't agree with that.
Okay.
It's hard to prevent someone who is really bent on committing a crime from getting them. It's unlikely gun laws are going to stop him, unless these guns aren't manufactured and aren't available. In the never-ending argument, tragedy can become a talking point. Luke O'Dell, a spokesman for the Rocky Mountain Gun Owners, a Colorado-based group that fights gun control measures, said private gun restrictions may well have had tragic consequences in the shooting.
Hmm.
So it was those darn liberals.
Oh, yeah.
He noted the theater chain that owns the Aurora movie house bans firearms on the premises and said that if other patrons had been legally able to carry weapons, the death toll might have been less, which is possible. Anything's possible. On the other hand, maybe it would have been more because maybe if other people pulled out their 40 caliber Glocks, what isn't this nice? What was his name? Holmes, right? What was his first name? You remember?
Why do you do that?
Isn't that strange? We can't even remember.
Well, it's right here. I'll find it.
Yeah. Anyway, that he was armored.
And James.
James Holmes, yeah. I don't know if you remember. God, it could have been. I saw this video just recently. About 20 years ago, these guys in full body armor were doing a stick-up, and they were fighting off the police, and they had automatic weapons, and they were, you know, the cops were shooting them dead on, and just everything bounced off. And the other thing is, why is body armor something that's commercially available? Why would anybody want body armor unless they were up to something that...
Or in the Secret Service or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, right. But a civilian... Yeah.
But in Colorado, is particularly lax with their...
Yeah, and everything that James Holmes did was legal. He had 6,000 rounds of ammunition.
Yeah,
right?
And what he did was, over a period of 2 months, I don't know if a lot of people know this, he had purchased these four guns at, I think, four different shots. But yeah, 6,000 rounds of ammunition, more than 3,000 for the assault rifle, 3,000 for the 40 caliber, the two Glocks, and 300 for the 12-gauge shotgun. All bought legally, it says the federal law enforcement.
I'll bet you there's 50,000 other people at a minimum that have that kind
of
armaments.
Oh, yeah.
And so what percentage of them are going to go berserk or coldly, maybe not berserk, go coldly murderous like that? Maybe he's the only one.
Maybe.
So you could say 50,000 to one. Does that warrant taking away or restricting other people having the so-called right to possess all this stuff? But it's really curious as to why people want all this in the first place.
I'm curious out to the listeners, because we have a lot of gun owners who listen to the show, and we have these conversations on a regular basis. Why? Tell me, why would you buy an AR-15 assault rifle? Why?
Yeah. Some people, I don't know, like to shoot them. That's okay. Casey writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's where you can reach us, by the way. By email, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, this should be the biggest news in the country. A witness says he saw a man take a phone call, then open the exit door for the shooter to come in. Why is this not being reported?
Really?
Well, Casey, you sent me the article that that it's from. I saw that as well. So I guess he means, why isn't it bigger? Are the cops a little quick to declare another lone nut? Now, I don't know. I know you can't apply logic to bat poop crazy, but odd things are not making sense to the kill everybody attack. One, a calm surrender, no suicide or death by cop. Two, booby trapping the apartment only to tell the cops that it's booby trapped.
Yeah.
He did this over months. So it's three, an intelligent, educated shooter who just happens to be into brain science. Oh, this is, you know, getting deep here. It kind of smells of a mind control assassin, RFK style. When the mission was over, he calmly surrenders and then saves the police lives by tipping off the booby trap. I don't get it either.
Yeah, it's very bizarre, the whole thing. Daywan wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com and said he's been hearing people calling other radio shows saying if more people would have been armed, blah, 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 like we've been saying, when are Americans going to get over this Wild West mentality? Well, I said, this is no way for a healthy society to be, I agree. These shootings also make another point for socialized health care for everyone. Maybe these people would be caught in some sort of mental screening and never have gotten any guns. Hadn't thought about that. Provided we can also somehow get real gun control.
Brian from Windsor writes, all those gunheads that say they would have been, if they would have been there with their piece on their side, that they would have ended it is a bunch of big talk. And it's easy to say that, especially if they weren't even there. Because in reality, if they were there with their gun, they would have hit the floor and crawled for safety just like the unarmed did. I mean, that does take a lot. I mean, I'll tell you, say you had, I don't know, sort of like one of those old-fashioned, 38 caliber police revolvers. And all of a sudden, you see this armored guy that has an AR-15. Are you really going to stand up and start shooting at him?
Don't think so.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's just a lot of smoke. Listen, we're on Facebook as well. We'd like you to join us there. Facebook.com/nightcall. Sarah is in tonight taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
And we have calls.
People are already all lined up. So, and let's try not to say the same things over and over again. You know, remember the thing. Okay. Well, I mean, go ahead. You can say what you want. You can say the same thing over
and
over.
Say what you want.
Say what you want. Yeah. Here's Thor in Belleville. Thor, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I was actually in your studio at night call. I'm a part-time musician. I'd like to weigh in on a different aspect of this. Being an older guy who has lived through a riot situation, specifically Detroit, my family and I lived on Cherry Lawn Street. And at that point, there was no police activity for days, and they finally sent, you know, National Guard tanks down. And my father had to defend our house literally with a sawed-off shotgun, and he actually rescued a girl who was shopping at Hudson's when they yanked her out of her car. And my dad rescued that girl at the point of a sawed-off shotgun, and the police said, you know, that's okay, Mr. Butler, you know, we're fine with that. It's all right. There were people shooting at the police from rooftops. So, I mean, when you talk about guns and stuff, it wouldn't take long for society to descend into chaos 3 days after the power goes out. But, I mean, look at Katrina. Look at Los Angeles. I mean, unless you've been in a real riot situation, I mean, then you'll understand what this is.
Well,
weren't you there, Peter?
Yeah, at Katrina, it was the cops shooting people and murdering people. I mean, cops got convicted of murder.
Well, did you see the crazy?
And you got to remember too, the police shot and killed, and some of the National Guard and some of the 82nd Airborne, the 101st Airborne that had been sent in 1967. You know, we're talking about July 23rd, 1967, when the big Detroit riot or rebellion, whatever you want to call it, and the investigation said that most of the shootings of the civilians were unjustified. All right, Thor. Thank you very much. I appreciate it very much. Here's Frank in Canton. Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, what's going on?
Nothing much. What's up?
Know, I was just listening to what you were saying there, and it sounds like you guys want the government to take more and more of our rights away.
What made you wait, Frank? Wait, Frank. What made you think that? What did I say?
Well, you said the Second Amendment was a so-called right. It's by the Constitution, it's a God-given right. It's not a so-called right.
Wait, you said what? You said it was a God-given right?
Yeah, you got to believe in God for that. We don't.
Yeah, and I don't think the founding fathers were rooting their
by any means. They wanted God out of it.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I mean, to sit there and say that it's a so-called right, you don't talk about the Constitution.
No, you're kind of mistaking. I'll talk about it any way I want, if you please, Frank. But what I was saying was that all law is subject to interpretation. And up until just recently, the Supreme Court had decided the Second Amendment applied essentially to the militias that are mentioned in the Second Amendment. Recently, the very conservative right-wing Supreme Court, or dominated by that political faction, decided that it, in fact, it extended to individuals. So in a way, I was just expressing my disagreement with them.
The Supreme Court's part of the establishment. There's nothing right-wing or conservative about them. There's nothing right-wing about the conservatives.
There's not?
Okay.
It's 5-4 conservative.
Well, I would say it's much more than that. But you got to go read the papers or something, Frank. Take it easy. They're not.
It sounds like some Tea Party stuff there.
Yeah. It sounds like, no, very uninformed. Hey, Chris in Westland. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. What's up?
You know, I was just listening, and you say you're always going to get these whack jobs, no matter what gun you own, what state you're in. And you know, it's sad, but it's taking the rights of gun owners like me and you. You know, you own a gun, I own a gun. It doesn't matter if you took all the guns away; you're still going to get a whack job. That gun in his hand and does something stupid, right or wrong.
But why should he be able to, in a period of 60 days, be able to go purchase all of these guns? Why should he be able to purchase that many and that much?
Oh, I totally agree. You know, I'm a former Marine, and I was involved in a shootout when I was 13 years old in the South. I was the second car behind the shooter, and, you know, we were almost shot as well. So, you know, not to that extent. But, you know, you always hear somebody, well, if I had a gun, I could shoot this guy and take him out. Yeah, I don't think so, buddy. You're going to do the same thing, like you said. You're going to hit the ground. You're going to be scared out of your minds.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
Every single day, to a point. You know, if I'm in a bad part of the neighborhood for work or what have you, absolutely, I do carry a pistol on me. You know, that's my right. I have a permit to do it. But, you know, my gosh, now you got these other guys that got this open carry thing going, and they just keep going with it. Like, hey, look at me. I can carry this gun out in the open.
So do you feel threatened just kind of in general society, like in the suburbs?
Absolutely.
You
absolutely.
Feel, wait.
Yeah.
You're saying, yes, you do feel threatened?
I don't feel threatened as much as scared, because you just don't – it doesn't take nothing to go take your CPL class. Now you have this right to buy this gun and carry it. And, you know, you can carry three guns on you if you want. You can carry as much ammo as you want. There's no restriction.
You know, there should be.
You know, Chris, if you're an ex-Marine, and I mean this very, very sincerely, you've got to be tougher than I am. I mean, I really mean that. Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have ever been a Marine.
You could take him down right now.
No, I couldn't.
No, he could take you down.
I don't have much worry. You know, I was born and raised, you know, just on the edge of the inner city in Detroit. I went to, you know, schools in Detroit. I still party a lot in Detroit. It would never occur to me to anywhere in my comings and goings in the city of Detroit, in the suburbs where I go, to ever carry a gun. I mean, sometimes I know tradesmen who are worried about, you know, the kind of equipment they have or, you know, the tools, sometimes, you know, bar owners and stuff like that. But I think you have a concern that's way...
Well, I'm not... I'm not that guy that... You know, of course, this is an open carry state. You don't even have to be permitted. You don't have to have no license to carry your gun in the open.
I know.
And a lot of people don't understand that. But the thing is, you hear about a shooting and automatically guns are bad. My dad was home from the Vietnam War a week into it. Two guys broke into the house. He shot and killed him.
Wow.
And he was a bad guy because he shot and I think he killed one wounded. I don't know the whole story, but he's automatically the bad guy.
But let's do this. Are you essentially saying that just like we sometimes when we have a picnic, it's going to be rained on, that that we're just going to have to put up with these Virginia Techs and these ordinary family shootings?
Just part of life.
Is that it? I mean, that's just what we're going to have to suffer as a country?
It's sad but true, though. I mean,
okay, let's leave it at that. I mean, that's one answer. I mean, I don't have any answer. That guy Frank kind of PO'd me, as you might have been able to tell. I'm not calling for. Well, yeah, I am. I would say that there is not a need for citizens to have
assault rifles,
and there used to be a ban on them, you know, up until 2004. And you know, the fake cowboy George Bush said, that'll be good. The NRA will love me, and I'll get more votes and all that.
And he did.
And you know, there's no need for body armor. There's no need for armor-piercing ammunition, all that stuff. I mean, and you could still have the weapons people feel they need. That's up to you. I mean, if you feel, you know, concerned, threatened, whatever, that's your decision, not mine. But that upping the ante in terms of weaponry and it's very possible if the cops would have come in there and started shooting at him, it would, you know, he would have been protected by his armor. All right, thank you for that. I appreciate it.
But even more people could have been killed. So.
Well, yeah, that's another thing. Here's David and Warren. David, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, what's up, guys?
Hey, David.
So I agree with you guys. We should not be able to buy body armor, and we should not be able to buy assault rifles. And I agree that we should have a stricter law on it. I mean, there's no need to have an extended mag for your handgun if you're carrying it out in the open. There's just no need.
Or anywhere. I mean, would you need?
I understand the point where you have to, if you feel safe with a gun, that's one thing. But, I mean, you don't see cops running around with a gun with an extended mag.
No.
So why should we be able to?
That's a good point.
Just saying, why would you allow citizens to have mass amount of ammo on them when you give a cop 10 shots?
You know, I think that's an excellent point. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked to two people that had been held up. And I said, what do you think would have happened if you would have had a pistol? And both of them laughed and said the identical thing, and they weren't at the same time. They said they would have got my pistol, too.
Right, right.
So it's not, you know, it's not a guarantee against that. But speaking, I'm up against a little bit of time here. Thank you for your opinion. That's an excellent point.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. And actually, if there are police officers, often we have police officers listening. Sometimes they're circling the building. Hi, guys.
Ah, we love you.
Well, yeah. Weigh in.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Get swimsuit ready and reveal your true shape. Discover Cellulize. Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Gray. A new technique that breaks up cellulite and fat directly underneath the top layers of the skin. Once cellulite fibers are destroyed, the skin looks smoother. Cellulite is no longer a reason to stay out of the swimsuit this summer. Summer 2012, reveal your true self cellulite free. It's possible. It's Cellulize.
Call 248-538-3333 or anewyou.com.
Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow. Nationwide, most women prefer scarless breast augmentation. I am Dr. Michael Gray, and I've been performing this scarless procedure for over 20 years now. It is still the number one choice among women choosing breast augmentation. Visit anewyou.com to see before and after photos of my scarless procedure. Schedule your complimentary consultation to learn why scarless breast augmentation could be right for you.
Call 248-538-3333.
I am Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I will see you tomorrow.
Do you need cash right now for any reason? Then you need Matt's Jewelry Brokers. At Matt's, they pay top dollar for your used or broken gold, silver, and platinum jewelry, class rings, belt buckles, coins, flatware, and more. It's really that easy. Stop into one of Matt's five locations with your items and walk out with cold, hard cash.
Hi, I'm Matt. We've been family-owned and operated for 30 years and pride ourselves on honesty, integrity, and paying more than the superstores do for your broken or used items just lying around the house. If it's collecting dust, we'll buy it. If it's broken, we'll buy it. If you don't want it, we'll buy it. So before you go anywhere else, stop by one of my five locations. In Macomb at 21 Mile and Romeo Plank, in Troy at Square Lake and Rochester Road, or my pawn shop in Southfield at 10 Mile and Greenfield. We're also in the Meyer in Clinton Township and Lenox. Check us out online at MattsJewelryBrokers.com or call us at 586-286-2866. That's 586-286-2866. When you need cash fast, go to Matt's.
Hey, this is Mike Rowe talking with Jim Twitchell, a real live Ford senior master technician. Can the work save me money on gas, yes or no?
Yes, by making sure that your car is in optimal running condition, you save yourself fuel.
Save money on gas with the works. $29.95 or less after $10 mail-in rebate. Click on the banner ad now.
Can you think of one good reason why somebody wouldn't bring their Ford to you for the works fuel saver package?
Honestly, Mike, no.
Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Claim based on EPA averages. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 8/31/12.
In case you haven't heard, Esurance wants to save you money on car insurance. It's also longing to save you money, and wishing, and yearning, and thinking it might be a nice idea to save you money. That's because Esurance was built to save you money. You know, cash, or clams, or greenbacks, sawbucks, simoleons, bits, chips, or scratch. Whatever you call it, you just might save it. That's insurance for the modern world. Esurance. Now, backed by Allstate. Click or call.
Visit esurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote. Not available in all states. Savings may vary.
just a worthless liar. I am just an imbecile. I will only complicate you. Trust in me and fall as well. I will find a center in you. I will chew it up and leave. Trust me, trust me, trust me.
Opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. We're talking about the Colorado theater shooting. And again, we've sort of lost the compassion for the people the victims that have suffered so much in that community. Can you imagine that, being in a community? Oh, you want your mic on, too?
What's going on over there?
Yeah, sorry. And a small community like Aurora, Colorado, yeah, and having 71 people shot, I mean, it's unfathomable.
It's hard to wrap the brain around
so
it all.
So what I said, first I heard of it, all these people without a bit of compassion in their voice or in what they were writing on these comment sections of the newspaper is, you know, they should add this, and liberals, you know, and they're trying to take our guns away and all that. Jerry writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, imagine the smoke-filled theater and just two more people with guns. Remember, this is what all these gun nuts are saying. Oh, if there would have been some licensed carriers there, they could have solved that in a second. Well, as I said, for one thing, the guy had all this body armor on, plus he's firing with this, you know, rapid-fire semi-automatic AR-15, and you've got your little pea shooter there. Someone suggested you'd just be hitting the ground trying to crawl out of there like anybody else. Mm-hmm. But even if you didn't, Jerry says, it's easy to picture a regular Joe trying to hit a killer and being mistaken by a third person as an assailant.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And Brian wrote in, once again, at this stage, aren't the suppliers concerned with who is ordering this stuff? No one ever seems to look into where it's going and have no problem selling it. Clearly not good.
Now, the word we're talking about is manufacturer. The manufacturers of things like Glocks and the rest of these armaments know that good proportions of it wind up in illegal hands. In this country, outside of this country, in Mexico, I mean, they really are death merchants. I mean, you may have some, you know, Second Amendment right, what would you call it? You should have it. Okay. But you got to understand that these manufacturers also supply the worst people in the world, the people you may be afraid of. They supply the James Holmeses. They supply the cartels in Mexico. They supply the Joseph Kona. What was it? Kona? What was his name?
Coney,
the Joseph Coneys in Africa. And when the United Nations tries to put into place a ban on international trade of automatic and semi-automatic assault rifles, there's the NRA saying you can't take away our gun rights. Yeah. So essentially what they're doing, you may have your gun, and like I say, the vast majority, probably 99.9999% of anybody with a gun is never going to do anything bad with it. But there's that 0.1%, or maybe it's a lot larger, are going to wind up doing the damage that are going to, and these are just the spectacular things. It's talking about, as we said earlier, 1 million people killed by guns in this country since the 1960s. And you have somebody, and we'll get to your calls in just a second. George Zimmerman, the man that killed Trayvon Martin, who said that Trayvon's death was God's plan.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
And now the prosecutors are saying, hey, we might just use that.
Thank you, George. You probably just convicted yourself.
Yeah, loser. Here's
what he was on this right-wing talk show on Fox News, Sean Hannity, who interviewed him. Why in the world would a conservative talk show host interview an accused murderer? Oh, I know.
Ratings.
Yeah. Well, ultimately that's it. Sure. But where is this? In an apparent attempt at damage control just 2 days after a cousin's sexual molestation charges went public, George Zimmerman broke his silence in an exclusive interview with Fox News conservative talk show host Sean Hannity. And he recounted the Sunday night. Now, listen to this language. He encountered a hoodie-clad black teenager.
My God.
Ooh, I'm scared.
Oh.
Ooh, that phrase.
There's a kid wearing a sweatshirt.
Yeah, who walked too leisurely in the rain.
This guy is seriously psycho.
Asked if he regretted getting out of the car that night or owning a gun, Zimmerman said no.
No.
Asked if he would do anything differently, Zimmerman said no a third time and added that Trayvon's death was God's plan.
Wow. Scumbag.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's thank him. He probably just handed himself a conviction.
Well, I sure hope to hell he did. And you know, when he was doing his apologies, this is really just makes me sick, Peter. He said that he's going through the list of everyone that he wants to apologize to. He starts with his wife. Then he goes to his family. Then he goes to his parents. Then his grandmother. And then the Martin family.
Yeah, the parents of Trayvon Martin. But then he said, well, he came back and did a little damage control because his attorney, Mark O'Mara, must have said, what did you just say? Are you out of your mind? He came back and he explained that he thought Hannity had asked if he was sorry he didn't get a lawyer at first and wished he hadn't spoken to the police so much or taken stress tests.
Oh, God.
And he says, in a wide-ranging interview with Fox News, Sean Hannity, He said he neither regretted carrying a gun that night nor pursuing the 17-year-old Martin. I feel it was all God's plan, he told Hannity. Asked if there was anything he might do differently, Zimmerman responded, no, sir.
Yeah.
This morning, the prosecution entered the tape of the interview into discovery, which is part of the trial process, and could attempt to admit it as evidence in Zimmerman's trial on charges of first-degree murder. Granting the interview will likely haunt Zimmerman, veteran legal analyst and defense attorney Mark Iglarsh told ABC News. He has impeached himself publicly. This is going to be a huge problem for him, and the prosecutors must be extremely pleased. He was making inconsistent statements that they can use in the trial against him. Let me see. This other attorney, Craig Sonner, said Zimmerman had independently been talking to Hannity and calling the Florida State Attorney Angela Corey against his advice.
And he claims he's not a racist. I'll tell you. I beg to differ.
Okay.
Really quick. Brian wrote in, why does everyone assume there was no one with a concealed weapon in the theater anyway? They're banned, right, in theaters?
Yeah, people could just carry them in.
Right. Yep.
All right, 313-298-WRIF. What I'm interested in, there was one caller. I mean, I should kind of write this down. One caller said, hey, you know, we live in a country, there's a lot of crazy people, there's no way to restrict gun ownership, and this is something we're just going to live with, just like we have to live with power outages.
Yeah.
And
I don't want to live with it.
Well, but so what's your solution?
I don't, exactly.
Okay. So what's your solution? Or is it just as this one caller said, this is what we're stuck with? Michael from Trenton, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, we're not stuck with anything. We can always do something. I want to talk about the Constitution. I don't know much about it, but I think I know a little more than that one guy.
Do you want my Constitution, Peter?
The Founding Fathers, they didn't know anything about these automatic weapons and the type of weapons that they got.
That is such a good point. I read that somewhere else. They didn't expect for these types of, you know, weapons to be manufactured. You're right.
And so they wrote that law for self-defense. If they would have knew that we had these kind of weapons, they would have never wrote that law. These were supposedly smart people. You know, that Constitution, it's a good document and stuff, but we're quite a ways down the road, and a lot of that stuff doesn't apply. I believe that we need to rewrite the Constitution to modern times now. We need to, but it's going to be hard to find the people smart enough to write the new document. But,
well, it could be. You know what?
People who aren't in the pockets of the NRA.
Yeah, which is most of the politicians.
Yeah.
Now, people say the Second Amendment gives you the right to bear arms. Now, the concern was about standing armies and the use of armies, the English army, to suppress rebellions and what have you. So the Second Amendment begins a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. I mean, so you're thinking, they're talking about a militia.
Yeah.
The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, you know, that it wasn't well written because that clause, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, has been interpreted now the Supreme Court to mean that individuals have the right to bear arms as opposed to it having to do with a well-regulated militia. So it's the law of the land. I mean, so we can't go there. But the Supreme Court, even the, which I do remember his name, Frank, that said, no, it's not a right-wing body. I mean, that even the right-wing justices allow that there can be regulations. Like, why, you know, if you, the keep and bear arms, can I have a bazooka?
Right.
You know, can I have fully automatic assault weapons? Can I have grenades? How about a tank?
Hey, let's just get a tank.
Why? Yeah, because where does it stop? I mean, why can I have a pistol and not a tank? I want a tank because I feel threatened.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to Detroit, so I'm going to drive a tank. All right. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I can't begin to tell you how much time I spend in Detroit.
I know. I'm down there a lot, too.
I don't need a tank. Here is Denny. Denny's in Pontiac. Hey, Denny, you're on the air. Welcome.
Here I go. Hello.
Hi, Denny.
Yeah, I just had a comment about what you had said a whole long time ago about AR-15 in the Air Force. You get an intelligent shooter with an AR-15, he will take out the Air Force.
The Air Force?
That's what you were saying earlier.
No. You mean when I said that citizens with armaments like AR-15 wouldn't be able to stand up to the 82nd Airborne?
Oh, yes, they would.
Well.
Well, there's another argument for citizens not being able to have it.
Yeah, I don't know. You know what? Well, he's talking about what if the government really became tyrannical.
Yeah.
And then it was up to the citizens, citizenry to defend itself against the armed forces of the United States that were being sent into, I mean, say it was like in Syria. So you have the Syrian army. We're the rebels. You know, we've got our AR-15s. And, you know, the 82nd Airborne, though, speaking of, they have some other armaments as well. They're called planes, tanks, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You're dreaming. You're just dreaming, Denny. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Here is Adam. Adam's in Farmington Hills. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi. One thing that seems to be missing from a lot of discussion is defensive use of guns and the statistics on that. Part of that is it's not really been well studied. But there was one exception a few years back, a sociologist named Gary Kleck, who, by his own admission, is a liberal and a card-carrying member of the ACLU, actually set out to, using sociological methods, study defensive use of handguns in the U.S. And he concluded that, on average, the defensive uses in the U.S. are roughly 1.5 million per year. And by his own admission, he lowballed it. That's a low-end estimate. So that's something to keep in mind, too, when you talk about how often guns are used.
Defense abuses? Meaning?
Defense abuses, where people are attacked and they use guns to defend themselves.
You know what? I've seen all these studies like that refuted, and I can't really get them. I'm actually trying to
do it while you're doing a talk show?
I can't do it. But let's...
We can do it in the commercial break.
Yeah. Let's do this. I will... You know, I've seen all of this, that overall, the guns protect more people than they injure, which I think... I mean, so... I mean, maybe they may say they do. There's still... We're talking about this mountain of corpses that are created that no other country like ours in the world has. So is there, like, just this peculiarity? He's gone. I didn't think I hung up on him. Okay.
Well, maybe he hung up.
Yeah.
Frank wrote in and said, hello, just a bit of information on body armor. The only commercially available bulletproof vests are level 1, which can only stop small caliber arms. Also, most bulletproof vests can only stop 2 to 3 bullets before the Kevlar starts to break down and the vest becomes useless. The Colorado shooter had a bulletproof vest and a riot helmet. Riot helmets are impact resistant, but not bulletproof. Anyway, thanks for the great show. Thanks, Frank.
So I wonder where this guy got all this. Here's Zenden in Flint. He's an ex-military police officer. What do you think about all this?
Well, I have several things to add into it. I'm an ex-military police SRT member, and I own an AR-15, but I am by no means a typical gun nut.
I don't think most people are to have them, yeah.
There's good reasons to have these weapons, and it's not because you need X amount of firepower. I bought my AR-15 for in case my family needs to defend itself. Something that not people realize is they have very low recoil, and I'm not going to give a gun to, let's say a future wife needs to protect herself from a burglar while I'm at work. I'm not going to give her a 12-gauge shotgun she's going to be afraid of and hurt herself with. I'm going to give her an AR-15 that she can handle without hurting herself.
Good luck.
Oh, my gosh.
You know what? My wife was talking about wanting to get a gun. And you know what I said to her? I said, don't take this the wrong way. But in a situation so critical that you would have to pull a gun on someone, I'm not real comfortable with you even being in that situation. Look, I lived in a crime-infested neighborhood quite a few years ago, and I used to do a lot of overnights here at WRIF, mm-hmm. rock shows. Some of people may remember, it's called the Riff Rock Cafe and all that. And while I was gone, my wife had this old military, World War II, M1 carbine, you know, those smaller ones the officers carried. And she slept with it under her bed with the safety off. And, But, you know what that said to me? I had the option, within this society to move out of a neighborhood where she even had to do that. And, the idea that you live in Flint, well, I don't know.
There's some bad.
Yeah, I live in Flint, but it's not so much that I want something with a higher rate of fire or anything like that.
Yeah, no, you want something that it doesn't have a big recoil.
Right. Not only that, but it also has a lot of stopping power. And if some guy is coming into your home, in my eyes, if somebody invades your property with the intent to harm or rob you, my personal views is they've forfeit any right to living beyond that.
Well, I don't know that I want to. Listen, I'm willing to defend myself and my family by any means necessary, and I have some of the means to do it. On the other hand, executing somebody because they're breaking into my house, I'm not real pleased at the prospect, and I don't know if you've ever killed anybody in your work, but I'm sure it's pretty traumatic to the person that does it. As well. But the idea that one has to prepare with weapons, with military weapons in a residential area, just doesn't seem to me to be necessary. But, it's up to you. All right, thank you very much. So this is why someone would have an AR-15, because when they get married they weren't there and their wife could shoot somebody with something that had stopping power and
I just don't think I could ever shoot anyone. There's that.
I don't mean to sound cold, but given the circumstances.
Yeah, I could.
Well, I wouldn't have any qualms, depending on the circumstances. But you know what?
And you're not a violent
person
at all.
Not at all.
We got an email from Michael who said, as evidenced by the 19 men who brought the World Trade Center buildings down, the most dangerous thing in the world is a man or woman who is ready and willing to die. All that is needed is a reason. What was his reason?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we're ever going to. Get out, apparently. Someone said early on, why did he just surrender? Why did he tell them that he had booby-trapped his apartment after he had gone such lengths to set it up? He apparently is spitting at the police officers in the jail.
He was.
And yet, I was just so startled.
That's all he had left was spit.
Yeah. It was so startling to see this video of him in this college classroom talking about video games.
Yeah, I got
to
look that up.
Wow. Here's Greg in East Point. Greg, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Well, first, I would like to say, since you were talking about earlier, that it is tragic that this many people had to die on what should have been an enjoyable evening. But the fact of the matter is this is really an aberration. You know, every night people go to the movies and people don't shoot up the place. It's not something you can really defend against. It wouldn't have made any difference if someone was in there, had a CPL, had, you know, 20-round magazine in their Glock and shot back. It's just one of those things that kind of happens.
Well, that's what, well, here, a couple of things. Someone said this is just what happens. Every once in a while, someone goes berserk. It's kind of, the problem is, too common in American society. I mean, this doesn't happen in Canada or England. I mean, in, where was it, in Denmark, that insane right-winger
Norway,
shot to death, like 71 kids. I mean, this was purposeful, and this was a political act on his part. But there's mass murders. There was someone in Michigan years ago, like a pissed off principal, or he got fired, and he took this truckload of dynamite and drove it to school and killed, I mean, this could have been 75, 80 years ago. So, yeah, I mean, there's something, a lot of men, I mean, this isn't very common for women. I mean, a lot of men go berserk. I mean, the history of the world has been men making it worse by acting out violent themes, to be sure. But, I mean, what is different about our country? Let me do this. I didn't give you much of a chance to talk, Greg. I got to do some commercials right now before the noon, before midnight. So let me put you on hold, and I will come back to you, and we'll revisit what you said. Get the rest of you on the air as well. All the lines are filled. Everybody wants to talk about this more when we come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Get swimsuit ready and reveal your true shape. Discover Cellulize. Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Gray. A new technique that breaks up cellulite and fat directly underneath the top layers of the skin. Once cellulite fibers are destroyed, the skin looks smoother. Cellulite is no longer a reason to stay out of the swimsuit this summer. Summer 2012, reveal your true self cellulite free. It's possible. It's Cellulize.
Call 248-538-3333 or anewyou.com.
Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow. Nationwide, most women prefer scarless breast augmentation. I am Dr. Michael Gray, and I've been performing the scarless procedure for over 20 years now. It is still the number one choice among women choosing breast augmentation. Visit anewyou.com to see before and after photos of my scarless procedure. Schedule your complimentary consultation to learn why scarless breast augmentation could be right for you.
Call 248-538-3333.
I am Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I will see you tomorrow.
You know that friend who's always coming up with the next big thing, like pasta for cats? Yeah, him. If he tells you about a great idea for an online car insurance company that's built to save people money, tell him Esurance has been doing that since pretty much forever. But his idea to start a brotel, the fraternity-style hotel, is awesome. Not like insurance for the modern world awesome, but good. Esurance. Now backed by Allstate. Click or call.
Visit Esurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote. Not available in all states. Savings may vary.
Detroit Rock Station. On the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
Show me how to lie. You're getting better all the time. And turning out against one isn't hard to teach. Another clever word sets off an unsuspecting hurt. And as you step back in the line, a mark comes to their feet. Now dance.
With a thousand lies and a good dance card, in a brand.
Diet Mountain Dew have the ultimate experience for any NASCAR fan. Listen to win a pair of tickets to Cedar Point, along with a Dale Earnhardt Jr. shirt and hat. Every Riff winner will also score exclusive passes to a VIP dinner at Cedar Point, where they'll get to sit in on a Q&A with Jr., winner of the recent Quicken Loans 400 at MIS, plus the chance to meet and get a photo off with the driver of the Diet Mountain Dew number 88 car in person. Listen and win from Diet Mountain Dew. Yeah, it tastes that good. And 101 WRIF, everything that rocks.
We're starting fresh right here, right now.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Bingo, that's the one.
Everything that rocks. You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
What happened?
That was the wrong piece of production
oh,
in there.
Oh, God.
We're back. It's supposed to say, now here's Peter and Jolene. Yeah, 313-298-WRIF.
Whoops.
Well, I was trying to look up. I remember a caller a little while ago. We're talking about the theater shooting and the role of guns. And do we have to accept the level of violence that's 20 times more than any other country like ours in the world? And, in fact, let me get back to that. The gun murder rate in the U.S. is 20 times higher than the 22 next richest nations combined.
We're number one.
Number one, number one. That's the only thing we're number one in now. World's, well, we're the wealthiest country world. The world's 23, among the world's 23 wealthiest countries, 80% of all gun deaths are American deaths, and 80% of all kids killed by guns are American kids. So what do we do? What do we do? Let's say that every claim that the NRA makes about that our country is safer and all of that is correct. Okay, we can give them the benefit of the doubt. I think they're full of it. I was looking for this study that the one caller mentioned. If you go to Snopes, SNOPES.com, and I just put in guns, and there's this Australian study that the NRA is always citing. And Snopes says it's a mixture of true and false stuff. But here is what is true. There's 100,000 people shot every year in the United States. 268 people every day are shot. Okay? Yeah. And you could say, well, you know, if it wasn't for everybody was armed and then no one, you know, crooks didn't know that someone was, you know, whether or not they were armed, it would even be higher. But, of course, a lot of the shootings, and I don't know what percentage, could be the majority of shootings don't have anything to do with crooks. They have to do with your husband or your wife or your brother or your, yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, we're all killing each other. And in fact, the fact that so many people are armed. Also, the proliferation of weaponry that makes some of you feel safer or some of you feel that you have to have a gun in order to feel safe is that these gun companies are supplying perpetrators with the guns. So the same gun that you have, that you're a law-abiding citizen, it's also they're cranking them out by the thousands to arm the worst people in this country with them as well. So what do we do? What do we do? You tell me.
Yeah.
By the way, George W. Bush is skipping the Republican convention.
I saw that.
Here this guy was elected twice. Of course, we think he stole the election in 2000 and 2004. But he is so toxic that he is staying away from the Republican convention.
He created all this crap. Yeah. I mean, Ronald Reagan did, but he sure put a nail in the coffin.
He's the man that lied us into two wars. He's the man that allowed 9/11 to occur by
and
his inattention.
Assault rifles.
Yeah, and to be, to
for anyone
proliferate.
To
and what did he do? Didn't he do something with the economy? Oh, yeah, he sank the economy.
Oh, yeah.
And and George Romney says,
Mitt.
Yeah, thank you. Mitt.
Pete wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com and said, I've always wondered why cars go 120 miles per hour when the speed limit is 70. Also, why did this guy pick the Batman premiere? Was he envious of Hollywood or something? Very strange and very tragic. I think for lots of people and gun owners, this whole tragedy hasn't even sunk in yet. Yeah. Democrats for Responsible Gun Ownership.
That's the name of his group?
That's what he said.
Wasn't there somebody wrote in from Minneapolis? Did we ever get his?
I'll look.
Maybe that was Brian.
I think it was.
Yeah, Brian was listening in Minneapolis. Paul Krugman, we'll get right back to the gun thing, but just talking about George W. Bush. According to Paul Krugman in the New York Times, he pushed through big tax cuts heavily tilted towards the highest income. As a result, taxes on the very rich are currently the lowest they've been in 80 years. President Obama proposes letting those high-end Bush tax cuts expire. Mr. Romney, on the other hand, proposes big further tax cuts for the wealthy. The impact at the top would be large. According to estimates by the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center, the Romney plan would reduce the annual taxes paid by the average member of the top 1% by $237,000. You know what? How many of you are, you know what percentage of people even make $237,000?
Yeah, I mean, small.
It's like 6 or 8% or something like that. These folks would, according to Bush and Romney, the twins here, they would reduce their taxes by $237,000. But the real upper elite, the real ruling class, the 0.1% that really rule us economically and to a large extent politically, they would save $1.2 million a year. And Paul Krugman says, no wonder Mr. Romney's fundraisers in the Hamptons out on Long Island attracted so many eager donors.
They want their money. They want more.
That there was a luxury car traffic jam.
Oh, God.
That's sick.
Sick.
What about everybody else? According to the Policy Center, Mr. Romney's tax cuts would increase the annual deficit by almost $500 billion. He claims that he would make this up by closing loopholes in a way that wouldn't shift the tax burden towards the middle class, but he has refused to give any specifics.
On how?
And there's no reason to believe him. Well, here's a guy that won't give up the information about his taxes as hell.
Yeah.
You know, Anne Romney, who is, sort of like Marie Antoinette, said, we've given you people all you're going to get.
Oh, she is disgusting.
Yeah, and here's what it is. And it was, I was going to make a historic analogy. They're really looking bad that they're only giving up like a year and a third information about their taxes.
Mm-hmm.
What could be the one thing worse than stonewalling the demand for the show of taxes like all the other presidential candidates have? What's in them?
Yeah.
The fact that their money is all in these, in the Cayman Islands.
Right, they're hiding something.
In Europe, yeah.
And just because we're talking about the economy right now doesn't mean that we're not going to go back
to guns
we have a bunch of phone calls to take.
Global super rich hoard $31 trillion in tax havens, and that includes Romney as well. Mitt. Yeah. Okay,
Mitt.
Back to these calls. Here is John in Rochester Hills. You're on the air.
Yes.
Hi.
Hey, Carl.
Sure.
I think you and I heard the same thing about the guy at the show that someone saw
someone let him in the back door.
Yeah.
He went out the door and all that, and then he must have came back in. Well, you know, those doors are one-way doors. We all know that. You know, an exit door.
Right.
At the theaters. So that was the theory that it would be two people. But then today I heard that he was already in the show and then left and got dressed out in the car, because his car was right by the door.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So maybe he went out and left it open somehow. Yeah. I have not heard this other person.
That's what I was thinking. You know, that's one thing. When those doors are open, it seems like, something, I'm not saying an alarm has to go off or anything like that, but, the whole purpose is to keep people from coming back in.
Sure.
And letting other people in for free.
I'll tell you, John, one of the things we're going to have to do is probably, wait for sure on a lot of this. But, that's one of the things we're going to be looking for. Thank you for your call. You know, I was thinking, too, about, the one caller who said he wanted the AR-15 because it had, this firepower.
Less
and didn't
recoil.
So when he got married and his wife could then use it if he wasn't there.
Here's a wedding gift for you, baby.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know whether it was with the 40 caliber Glock that he was carrying or the assault rifle, but it went right through the wall. And that's one of the things.
Into the next theater.
Into the next theater and wounded somebody. And that's one of the things that with high velocity weaponry is that the they're you just don't want to be using them in close.
You would think.
Yeah. All right. Let's continue on. Here is Steve. Steve, you're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Warren.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I just want to say that I personally own guns, and all of us Americans own guns. I mean, everybody buys guns every day from your local gun shop to the gun shows on the weekends. I mean,
well, there is more gun shops in America than McDonald's.
No kidding.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's almost, I can't even believe that.
Well,
because there's a McDonald's down every corner.
And Subways, too. They're popping up all over.
Actually, though, just to be accurate, about 40% of households have guns.
Right. And what I'm trying to say is that Americans buy guns. They have hobbies, interests. They, hunting, shooting ranges, and, basically self-defense. And it's not every day where someone's going to go plan an attack and buy four guns to go gun down, a theater. It's just the world that we live in with 7 million people. You're bound to have a few of those lunatics out there that can do something like that.
Well, why do you think there is so much more of that in this country than any other country like ours in the world? In other words, a fairly wealthy industrial country. Because, like I said, is that we have a murder rate 20 times all the rest of the countries like ours combined. And what was it like? I don't have that in front of me. Like 80% of all gun murders are done in the United States in these 23 countries.
Yeah.
So we got maybe we just got crazier people. So,
and
then, what do we say? Well, okay. Well, that just goes with the territory. All right. Thank you very much. Oh, you know what? I forgot about Greg. Greg, I'm sorry. You got disconnected.
Greg.
Right? Greg, you're back. You're going to have to refresh my memory. What you were saying?
Okay. We were just, talking about the comparing the United States with other countries, Canada. I go to Canada quite a bit. They do have crazies there too. I was in Vancouver a few years ago on business, and there was a drug lord that got shot up in the basement of his condo. He couldn't even recognize the car he was in. It had so many bullet holes in it. This is a country that purportedly doesn't have guns.
Well, also, there has just been two major shootings in Toronto. There was a shooting at the shopping mall. In fact, there's one of the women who got killed in Aurora in the theater showing Batman.
Survived that,
yeah. And then also, I think the other one, I forgot what, Hilux or something, but there was just some shooting, gangland shooting.
The point is that you just, there's going to be people that are bent on mayhem,
right.
And and this case in Colorado is a unique in that this appears to be very well thought out. He started a few months ago acquiring the guns, acquiring the ammunition, acquiring everything that he needed to do this. It was an incredible amount of planning went into this. So this wasn't something where somebody just basically snapped and decided to shoot up a
mall. No, it was
like that. This was
well
somebody
considered.
That if he wasn't able to purchase the guns legally, he probably would have found some other way to achieve his means.
But if he would have had a big knife, it would have been a little harder. I mean, or if he would have gone at it with guns, like say brought a shotgun, which he had, and mm-hmm. did some damage with that, a 12-gauge shotgun at close quarters, and it was a military issue, which means that it probably had a pretty short barrel and, wide spread on it. What do you think about this? A lot of what people are saying is this is it. Maybe Canada has a low murder rate. Maybe Sweden and Switzerland have low murder rates and what have you. And people look at our country aghast. And we do seem to have a lot of very, very angry people here that act out. But as I always said, 99.9% of people that own guns don't do anything negative with them or anything illegal with them. How about this? What about automobiles? We do accept the fact that we know that, and I forgot what it's down to now, but about 30,000 people a year are going to be killed by automobiles. Mm-hmm. We know it. I mean, if somebody said, look, I'm going to create, this is like an argument for the people that say, well, this is it. But if someone says, I got an invention, people are really going to be able to get a lot of pleasure or, help them. But It's going to kill 30,000 people a year, and there's going to be probably, half a million people severely injured. It's going to do billions of dollars of property damage. You're talking about cars here. They would say, there's no way in the world that we're going to let you introduce this. So maybe you could argue, hey, you know, just like you were just, I know two people one woman that was killed that we know driving a car and another woman who has been crippled for life because, you know, she was driving legally, both of them hit by semis.
Yeah.
I
think we all kind of know someone who's...
Or we know that somebody's going to come running into a high school or a college or a workplace or their family home and shoot them up. So maybe it's just another dangerous machine. Is that a way to look at it?
I guess.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
A lot of ways to look at it.
Yeah. Speaking of Canada, here I don't have the name up, but this is a call from Windsor. Who's this?
It's Mike.
Mike. Hi, Mike from Windsor. Hi, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I want to comment on how Canada's gun laws are really laxed. Not like popular opinion might be over in the States. It's very easy to achieve a gun license over here. It's just a one-night course, a couple $100. And, like myself, I own two rifles, and I am, I'm licensed to carry a handgun, too.
Do you have to give a reason in Canada or in Ontario?
No reason at all.
Okay, because it used to be in Michigan quite a few, maybe 20 years ago, the only people that could get concealed weapons permits were people that could state to a board, a county board, why they had an abiding need for it. In other words, I own a bar and I'm coming out of the bar with $700 in my pocket. If you just walked in there and said, I just would feel a lot safer and I feel like I could protect my family and myself better, they would say, sorry, that's not a good enough reason, but
okay, it's not necessarily concealed here, but I'm allowed to own them, purchase them, and it's really simple. I was actually blown away. I'm just a regular Joe. I'm not like part of Brinks or I don't do security. I'm not an op or nothing, and no problem getting that. Even with a criminal record, as long as it's not violent, you have no problem getting it. And gun ownership here in Canada is huge. Contrary to popular belief, again, you ever watch Bowling for Columbine?
Yeah,
yes.
Sure.
Yeah,
the Michael Moore film.
Yeah, I'm sure you have with your. With your left wing ideals, I'm sure you've watched that guy.
But you know what? I have friends of mine live in Toronto, and every time I go to their house in Toronto, I always try to. Remember all the doors were open.
Yeah,
and
in the movie.
My friends' doors are always locked in Toronto.
Yeah, I live in Windsor, and actually in a real nice neighborhood, and I lock my doors all the time.
Yeah.
But
wait a minute. Let's go back to. Is it easy to get a concealed weapons permit in Ontario?
You cannot get concealed.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Okay.
No.
Right.
No, but as far as, like, purchasing, like, I got a semi-automatic 22.
Yeah.
14 rounds, tubular feed, no problem.
Is that for...
So I think the question you're talking about is actually the ease of actually purchasing these...
The ability to... why should someone have an AR-15? That's my question.
What do you do, target shooting?
Yeah, target shooting, hunting.
Yeah, not with the 22. Or what are you going after?
Chipmunks? No, you can do varmints and all that. That's more target, but
varmints.
I got a nice 308 Winchester, which is a good...
I have a little varmint chipmunk that hangs around my house. He's so cute.
Yeah, I would
never do that.
All right. Thanks for making our show international.
I appreciate it.
Have a good one.
David wrote in from Washington State. Good show tonight. As for owning an AR-15, especially for its stopping power, is, well, weird. I mean, for Christ's sake, all one needs is an 870 Remington. I'm learning a lot about guns tonight. Yeah. Pump action shoot gun. Now, that would really be a home protection firearm for sure. Sad to hear that weapon was used in Colorado. best bird hunting gun ever made.
Well, there's nothing like
little birds. Leave the little birds alone.
I say nothing. There's nothing like the you know, a shotgun racking to make someone head the other direction.
And
but
you know what else he said? He said, "P.S. I thought the Idaho neo Nazis." He's listening to the show live right now. I thought the Idaho neo Nazis out here were rad, but damn, my friends, the Detroit area region gun wackos are totally scary.
You know, I'll have to defend them. I don't think anybody so far has been
scary.
No one has.
Don't be scared. It's just because you, Detroit.
You're in Washington. Yeah, we're here in Detroit. Yeah. All right. Let's go to Matt. Matt's in White Lake. Matt, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good, actually.
Good. Yeah, I'm just saying, I carry a CPL. I have a license in this state, and I actually run a restaurant, and then I do it because I feel that it's a lot safer for me running a restaurant with cash on hand. We're right off the freeway, so you never know who can easily access
right.
the restaurant.
Yeah, we were saying that that's often the case. Yeah.
In fact, that's traditionally, as I was saying, who would wind up with the concealed weapons permits. You know,
in Michigan, anybody can get one as long as you don't have a
right.
criminal background.
Yeah. Now, but like I say, you know, I mean, somebody says to me, you know, if they, I get, you know, people, they live in like northern Oakland or Macomb County, and they're telling me that they feel they've got to carry a concealed weapons in order to feel completely secure. I think, wow, man, maybe they ought to, I can't believe they're driving without wearing a crash helmet, you know, or.
Yeah, you know what? I agree with you. I don't feel 100% concerned. It's more of a sense of security, really.
Well, I think if, like I say, a business owner, if someone carrying cash could be a target for, you know, for criminals, for absolute sure. All right, thank you very much. Stay safe. Well, stay safe, everybody. Yeah.
Yes.
We do have
a couple of open lines, by the way.
Oh, all of a sudden, yeah. Here's Casey listening in Florida. Casey, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, I was just calling to weigh in on, Florida's gun laws. Like, I'm up here on vacation right now, and it's just, it's really a lax gun law that they have, down in Florida, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Florida's a curious state.
It really is. It's, they just have so many different, like, laws, you know, they vary so much compared to up here.
Well, it's like the one with Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, that, you know, was it shoot to kill or what is it? Stand your ground.
Stand your ground law. Yeah, yeah. They even say, like, I'm going for law enforcement currently. I'm trying to get a job for the Florida Highway Patrol and mm-hmm. with the stand your ground law.
Oh, I have a friend. I have a connection for you. I have a friend who's.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm trying to get in right now. I mean, but it's just, it's so, you know, different with that, like that Trayvon Martin case, you know, is the stand your ground law. Someone could come up and basically push you or try to swing at you and you can pull out your gun and shoot them, you know?
You say you felt threatened. That's
yeah,
it. Right.
That's
right.
All you say.
Yeah.
That's all you say. And that's your defense right there. And that guy, that caller from Canada was talking about how lax their laws are, and it takes only a day to get, you know, he said he was getting shotguns in a day. In Florida, I went down and bought my, I have a 12-gauge pistol grip, and it literally took me, I was in and out of there in 20 minutes.
No
doubt.
Put
background check, nothing.
Well, out of
that,
yeah.
Mine.
Yeah.
And,
it's like going to the grocery store.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's funny that you mentioned that. I work at a grocery store in Tarpon Springs there, and we actually had a shooting a couple of years ago, and the case got tried, and that was my first day of work, and it got shot up, and it was...
Oh, my gosh. Welcome to your job.
Well, yeah. you know, pardon me, usually during the summer, you could come up from Florida to cool off, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be 101 here today.
Drag.
Yeah. All right, Casey, thanks for listening and thanks for calling.
Get another job to pay for the AC.
I know. Absolutely. Here's Seth in Grosse Pointe. Seth, thanks for joining us here on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Hey, you asked the question, why is our country different than these other countries?
Yeah.
Right.
And I might be coming from a little bit of a different angle here, but if you let me say this for a minute here. The question was, why is the country different? When you put us on commercials there on the last break, there was three consecutive commercials that I heard. And this is no offense to your radio station or anything, but the first one was an advertising for a stripping club and
yeah.
how to bring strippers to your house or to your party or whatever.
Well, yeah, second they do the delicious duos and all that.
Exactly. Second commercial was about condoms and sexual whatever that was.
Condoms are good.
Yeah.
And the third one was how to protect men against divorce and that such. And now to go directly to my point, on the United States of America's coin, it says, "In God We Trust." And I believe that, you know, in the past and in history, our country has been prosperous because most people did trust in God. And I think that that is kind of fading. And I think as that fades and people are losing their trust, I think that's a direct relation to how our country is degrading.
Well, how about this, Seth? There, certainly the countries in Europe are much, much more irreligious than ours. And, in fact, of those 23 countries, the United States has got to be the most religious country of all.
Right? I was going to say that. This is a very Christian nation. So how come the elections go?
I mean, nobody goes to church in Sweden or Denmark or Finland or any place like that. I mean, it's like almost an they're almost like atheist countries.
And you're also talking to a couple of atheists.
That's all right. I thought I'd throw my point out there.
Okay.
And total respect to your feelings, man.
Okay, yeah. And another thing that I think that might be is I think in the Bible, the Israelites knew what they were doing wrong, and they believed in God, and then they turned away. And that might be more of an effect here where people are turning away from trusting in God, and they want to get rid of it completely. And I think that might be more of the effect.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that opinion. How about this? An Israeli lawmaker has torn up, this made me think of this, that an Israeli lawmaker has torn up a copy of the New Testament in front of cameras in his parliament office. An aide says Christian missionaries mailed the Christian scriptures to Michael Ben-Ari of the Ultranationalist National Union Party. And Itamar Ben-Gvir said Ben-Ari, an Orthodox Jew, was enraged to receive the book in whose name, he says, millions of Jews were slaughtered. Ben-Ari tore it up, he said, then posed for photographs with the destroyed Bible.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I hope he feels better. I mean, really.
Yeah. What happened to my fish story, though?
I don't know. I'll look for that somewhere.
I'll look for that.
Hans wrote in to culltechyes@yahoo.com. Curious as to why, if you were a body armor company, it would be wrong, or is there some law against notifying authorities that a civilian purchased them? If you own the company, unless it was sent to law enforcement or military, wouldn't it concern you that it was, as in this case, maybe being sent to an apartment, especially in this day and age? It's not a bit odd to anyone? And that's in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Hans.
Where my mother
was born.
I mean, wouldn't it, you could only think that a civilian would want it for nefarious reasons.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I want some body armor because I'm going to Detroit.
Yeah, I need it.
And they won't let me have a tank.
Here, Peter.
Oh, there
you go.
Yeah, that, Sri Lankans name a new fish after atheist Dawkins. Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion, he's an evolutionary biologist.
An atheist.
And so Sri Lankan scientists have identified a new genus of freshwater fish and named it after renowned atheist Richard Dawkins.
I thought this was just...
Yeah, the new genus named Dawkinsia. Maybe this is a joke. Dawkinsia.
We better go on Snopes.
It comprises 9 species that are found only in South Asia and are characterized by long filaments that trail from the dorsal fins of males.
Atheist fish.
Atheist fish, yeah. Let's see. An ectheologist, this fish guy, I'm not saying him. An internationally acclaimed conservationist said extensive studies in India and Sri Lanka showed that the level of diversity among such fish was, quote, much greater than previously suspected. That was partly the reason the study group had chosen to name the new genus after the 71-year-old Dawkins, the British author of the anti-religion polemic, The God Delusions. It doesn't make a bit of sense, does it?
Well, I don't know. I thought it was funny. Rick in East Point wrote, "It's our entertainment. Why so much gun violence in America? How many murders are on crime shows every night? How about all the shoot 'em up video games? We live in a culture of violence. It prepares our young people when they become soldiers."
Oh, yeah. I forgot about this, too. It says...
You're back on it?
Back about the Israeli lawmaker who tore up the New Testament.
Yeah.
I meant to do this. Ben-Ari, an Orthodox Jew, was enraged that he to receive the Bible in the mail, so he tore it up and then posed for photographs with the destroyed Bible.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
No longer will your voice be silenced. No longer will your opinion be marginalized. This means you. And you.
And me?
No, not you, dumbass.
Huh?
But those attractive people around you, they can now make their voices heard with the Riff's daily web poll.
Yeah!
Remember, citizens, your opinion matters. And expressing it to complete strangers over the internet is the most American thing you'll do all day. The Riff's daily web poll. Brought to you by Bastille Systems, the summer's ultimate drunk accessory. Vote now. Now at WRIF.com. This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
Rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
I'm so addicted to all the things you do when you're rolling around with me. In between the sheets or the sounds you make.
WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much and welcome to our final segment. I think we haven't talked about anything other than guns in America.
And a little bit of economy, but...
Yeah, well, we were doing that, yeah. At 1 a.m., which is coming right up, Dana Frank, who wrote a book about Detroit, Women Strikers Occupy Chain Win Big. This is way back in history. This is such a great story. It tells the story of the 1937 Detroit Woolworth sit-down strike of shop girls. And this was right downtown. Woolworth's was this big national chain, in fact, international chain, what they called five and dime stores.
Yeah.
And there was this shop in the corner of, store with a soda fountain and all this.
They've got the little counter.
Counter. And these shop girls, they said, well, wait a minute. All the strikers are doing that at GM up in Flint. We're going to do it, too. So it's a great story.
You know, that was really brave back then.
It was. And they were like 18, 19 years old as well. And then Danny Dorling calling in from Sheffield, England, no doubt,
really?
With this crystal clear reception.
Yeah.
And there's this no nonsense guide series. You can go to I think it's either nononsense.org or nononsenseguide.org. And you can find No Nonsense Guide to Almost Every Subject Under the Sun.
Very seriously.
Nice. But this is random. The No Nonsense Guide to Equality, talking about the growing disparity of wealth in the U.S. and Britain. All right.
Excellent.
Quickly, let's go back to our phones and pick up Mike in Westland. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, how are you guys?
We're good.
Great, hi.
Thanks for calling in.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I think it's a total cop-out that we focus on. You can't stop a guy like this. Maybe you can't stop him, but you can limit the amount of damage he can do or the ease with which he can do it.
Thank you.
If you go back to Gabriel Giffords, the congressman in Arizona, the guy had a Glock with a 33-round magazine. As soon as he was done shooting, the crowd subdued him. He stopped shooting. Now, if he'd had a 10-round magazine, less people shot, less people dead.
Sure.
All that said, I hope that the Democrats don't try and make an issue out of this ledge issue until after the November elections, because if a congresswoman shot in the head can't change it, I don't think this will either.
You got it, because the polls all show, Mike, that it hasn't changed anybody's mind. People think that we ought to just enforce the laws that are there. Well, the laws that are there, as you were saying, permit a whole lot of weaponry that really isn't necessary for anything other than what we saw. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Why did I let you give me that piece of pizza?
It's just a little bite.
I know that that did it. Let's go back over to Windsor, get another international view. Here's Jake. Jake, hi. You're on the air.
Hey. I heard you guys talking about the economy and guns and whatever.
Sure. Well, yep.
What if, say, the Republican Party of whatever in the States, right,
uh-huh,
was using fear to drive up gun sales?
They are.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're big promoters of it, and the gun manufacturers and the NRA are the big supporters of the Republican Party.
And they love fear. That's their thing.
Well, if they use their fear tactics of, like, Fox News, whatever, and drive up gun sales.
Which they've done, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't think of the name of the first Batman film where they use this gas to induce this insane paranoia on everybody's part. Anyway, yeah. I mean, a fearful population is a population that's easy to control, for one thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they use that to stay in power. Use guns or fear to drive up gun sales. And once, you know, gun sales are up and everybody's got a gun, people start to feel safe, quote unquote. But, you know, the thing is, if you have a gun, what's to stop you from thinking so-and-so has a gun, concealed or not?
Yeah, it's all this paranoia, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the sort of the revolving trajectory of it, if you will. Can you have a revolving trajectory?
I don't know.
All right. Again, thanks for making our show international. Thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate it. I meant to ask him, it's kind of hard, you can say. I was going to say, how do Canadians view us? But you say, like, you know, how do people in the United States view Canada?
I think they think we're crazy.
Well, yeah, maybe.
I know they do. I've talked to many of them.
All right. Here's Regina in East Point. Hi, Regina. You're on the air.
Hello, friends.
Hi.
Hi, Regina.
I really am enjoying your show so much tonight.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks
for listening.
Peter was saying he lived in Detroit.
Yeah.
And I wanted to mention it. My grandmother was 90 years old, refused to move out of her house. I took her shopping. Beautiful day. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I got mugged.
Oh, no.
And everybody in the whole parking lot shut their doors and locked themselves in. And boy, did I learn a lesson that day. Boy.
Wow.
I got everything back, and I had to go to the precinct, and they lost my money. And then I went to Frank J. Murphy Hall of Justice. Oh, my God. The guy didn't even get anything because he was on cocaine.
That's the old cocaine defense. I couldn't help it, man.
He was on cocaine. And I'm sitting there risking life and limb just to be down in Detroit. I swear to God, I was scared. But anyway.
We love Detroit. We go there all the time.
Yeah, I think you're safe, particularly at the Murphy Hall of Justice. All right, Gene, I got to move on quickly indeed. Let's see. Here is Jeff in Clarkston. Jeff, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, dear listener.
Okay.
Hey, I hate to scare, I don't want to scare you guys, but Michigan gun laws are real similar to Florida in that, you know, we have the stand your ground law as well here.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
Yeah. And,
It is scary. I am scared, actually.
Yeah. And, the previous caller, I think it was Mike or Mark, more laws aren't going to prevent this nut job in Colorado, things like that happening.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that if there would have been laws prohibiting how much ammunition someone could purchase legally? I mean, you know, the argument is someone could have just done that illegally as well. I mean, obviously, all the criminals that have weapons and you talk about a society where everybody's armed. Hey, it's Mexico, right?
Well, you know, a 30-round clip or a 10-round clip, you take a 10-round clip and plug a new one in, it's almost as fast as having 30 rounds. Just, we don't need any more laws in this country. That's all I'm trying to say.
Well, I think you could begin to, I mean, if somebody has, where there's a will, there's a way. Mm-hmm. But I would like to make it as inconvenient as possible for people to have weapons that are only designed to do a great
mass
damage
murder
to other people. Yeah. If you want home defense, you don't need an AR. Contrary to what our one listener said.
Right.
You don't need an AR-15.
Get out.
You certainly don't want. I mean, if somebody came to your bedroom.
Like a little handgun or something.
Yeah. I mean, you shoot somebody with a 40 caliber Glock, man. It'd go through them, through the walls, and kill your neighbor next door. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I have mace and a dog. That's what I have.
Well, yeah, there you go.
Well, and a man.
Yeah, those guys come in handy for a few things,
yeah,
right? Here's Dominic and Taylor. Dominic, thanks for joining us here on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I got two comments. One was with the economy the way it is and how they're laying off police forces now.
Yes.
Now would be the time to own a gun compared to, 10 years ago. Just in Taylor, where I live, I've watched the crime rate go up and up. And they're getting rid of police.
Well, yeah, as everything goes down, people are more desperate, more crimes are committed.
I'm surprised there isn't
more
crime.
More, yeah.
But it's what I said, though, you know, that if there's more guns, the crooks are going to have more guns. But, you know, what we should be addressing, well, I mean, what we really need is, and I think we've despaired of any large circulation. I mean, because, you know, I was thinking of, I was looking at these people in Syria. Can you imagine just living in Detroit or Taylor or Troy or someplace like that, and all of a sudden the government's bombing you, and you go, whoa, we got to get across the border to Canada, and everything you know is, you know, and you leave everything
right
that, you know, your whole
behind
life is behind you. Well, what we really need to do is think about larger solutions. I mean, why do we have an economy where the upper third is doing just fine, thank you very much, and the two-thirds below us, below that, are doing, you know, depending.
Eating dirt, man.
Well, I mean, depending on where, you know, the people at the 66th percentile aren't eating dirt. But then
you just,
the further down the line you go, the more desperate the circumstances, and the more desperate people you get, the more, the less they, you know, the old.
There's more crime.
Yeah. I mean, Bob Dylan's line, you ain't got nothing to lose. So
that's true.
Why not do that? All right. Thank you very much.
Well, Bob had a lot of good words, didn't he?
He did.
Oh, he still does.
He does. Yeah. Here's Jim and Wayne. Jim, hi. You're on the air.
Yeah. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Hi, Jim.
Good, good. There's a few things that I wanted to discuss. Obviously, we don't have a lot of time.
Yeah, we're winding down, but go ahead.
Yeah. First of all, I think the reason why people in the suburbs are a little bit more concerned and arming themselves a little bit more heavily is because that city that you guys love so much has bled into the suburbs to the point to where the crime rates out here have gone through the roof. so they don't have a choice but to arm themselves.
Well, I'll tell you, I live in a suburb.
We're close to Detroit.
It's just close to Detroit. My neighborhood's pretty crime-free. I mean, I'll tell you.
There's been a couple of, like, robbery break-in sprees, but they caught them.
Yeah, there are. I mean, people from Detroit have come into Ferndale and Warren and, those kind of border cities and committed crimes without a doubt. But I don't know,
I still feel pretty safe.
Yeah. I mean, I feel very safe in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in fact, we know from the stats from our block club and the police that come to it, that we live in actually a pretty low crime rate. But you are taking something of a risk too. I mean, having a gun may secure you. I mean, because what you think, here somebody breaks in and then you say, hey, MF, you just made a major error coming into my house. Put your hands up. Or if you're really cruel, just shooting the person down. Like some people said, once they enter your premises, they've forfeited the right to live. Whatever it is. However, there are some drawbacks to having guns in the house. There's all sorts of accidents. Children get them. So it's a mixed bag.
It just happened with someone from my hometown, and the kid was being bullied. His dad was a hunter, had those guns locked up. Not sure how he got in, but he shot himself, killed himself.
Wow, that does happen. All right, thank you very much. So, I don't know. I mean, it's a mixed bag, but I don't know. We drive our cars. I mean, every time we get in that car, you know, who knows?
Which is scarier than getting in a plane.
Yeah.
And the drunk drivers out there, oh, my gosh. I'm not a big late-night person. You know that, Peter.
Yep.
I mean, I am, but not driving around town. And I came home from a gig for the radio station on Friday night, and it was midnight, and there were some drunk-ass people on the road. I was terrified. I couldn't wait to get home.
I want to get this guy, and he's anonymous. He's from Michigan, he is a firefighter, but... doesn't want to say
that's
from where.
Fine.
That's fine. Yeah, go ahead. Do you want to give a shout out to the first responders in Aurora?
Hello?
Yeah, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I listened to the dispatch radios that were released online, and the Aurora Fire Department did a tremendous job in establishing command and, taking control of the situation that was handed to them.
Oh, at the apartment, you mean?
Well, not even the apartment. I'm talking about the fire department at the theater.
Okay.
They were kind of handed something that was bizarre, crazy, that doesn't happen, too often.
It's very big. It was very big.
I also heard some of the docs were saying that they just worked as a team incredibly together because they had been trained to do this. And it made me think, first off, I was sure glad that they had, because if you can imagine, you had no thought that anything like this would ever occur. But the idea, and I keep getting back to that we have to expect things like this to happen and that we have contingency plans for how to deal with mass murders or other events like this in our society is a pretty sad commentary.
Yeah,
but
sure,
yeah,
is.
I think we all want to give them a big shout out. But all right, thank you very much, Mr. Anonymous.
It's the reality, though.
Yeah. Here is Nick and Troy. Nick, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, what's happening? Just wanted to point out, I'm not a gun enthusiast, but states like, I know they're desolate, like Alaska, Wyoming, but even Vermont, which, is a small state and not a huge population, have absolutely the most liberal gun laws of anywhere. In Vermont, for example, you can own a gun, carry a gun, own a gun without any permits. You can own a machine gun, anything you want to own.
No. There's federal prohibitions against automatic weapons. Yeah, I mean, for sure. So maybe, the idea, they used to, one of the defenses is guns don't kill people, people kill people. Or, I mean, it's people with guns that kill people. But maybe some populations are more trustworthy.
Perhaps. Perhaps.
All right, I'm going to get one more quick call. Nick in Farmington Hills, you got about time for two sentences. Go ahead. Give me the headline.
How you doing? All I got to say is, and you just touched on it, guns don't do anything. It's the people that have the guns that do it.
Why do we have such crazy people in this country, though?
And you know what?
It's stupid people everywhere, man.
Oh, hey, Nick, you know what? And why does anyone disagree with that? I'll never get that.
All right, Nick, thank you very much. Thanks for being our last caller. All right, stay tuned for the story of how some teenage shop girls
said, we're not going to take it anymore.
All right, Jalene, it's Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah.
And Sarah, we'll have a podcast of this show up at noon tomorrow.
I'll try to be up by then to post it.
Yeah. Oh, you okay. And you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and you can link to it from there. Also, WRIF.com. And hey, we like likers.
On Facebook.
Yeah, so it's facebook.com/nightcall. Next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com. Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com.
Mother, tell your children not to walk my way. Tell your children not to hear my words, what they mean, what they say, mother. Mother, can you keep them in the dark for a while? Can you hide them from the wedding world?
Send you to Cedar Point to meet Dale Earnhardt Jr. in person. Get all the details online at WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Ah, boy, you know, history, what's the old thing? If you don't learn from it, you're condemned to repeat it. Well, we do it over and over again, and usually we're thinking about negative lessons, but there's some positive ones through history as well. The way ordinary people like you and me have made history. And if you don't think I'm an ordinary person because I'm a media guy, then people like you have made history throughout the world's history, to be sure. And some of you have listened for a long, long time may remember that about 11 years ago, there was a wonderful book that came out that called Three Strikes. And it was about three strikes that were very significant in, well, a lot of their different aspects. Howard Zinn wrote one, the great late historian. Another one was put together by Robin D.G. Kelly, the story of a movie theater's musician strike in New York. And the one, the author that I interviewed was the third strike, and that was Dana Frank. And she brought to light this little-known sit-in, sit-down strike that was conducted by what were called counter girls. And guess where it was? Woodward Avenue and Grand River Avenue. It was during the Great Depression. It was 1937. And Detroit, of course, was much different all those years ago. 75 years, I guess it is now. And it was the center. It was downtown. The suburbs were nada. And people came downtown to go to Hudson's and go to Crowley's and go to Woolworth's as well. And now out in a pamphlet, Women Strikers Occupy Chain Store Win Big, the 1937 Woolworth sit-down. And my guest is Dana Frank. She's a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the founder of the UCSC Center for Labor Studies. And it's a pleasure to welcome back after quite a few years, Dana Frank. Hi, Dana.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe is it possible to paint a picture of what it was like 75 years ago in downtown Detroit?
Well, certainly, as you say, there wasn't out there, we didn't have the suburbs in the same way, and working class people would go downtown to shop, and one of the big places they would go was the Woolworth store. And Woolworth, you know, used to be the place that everybody knew about. It was sort of basically the Walmart of the early 20th century. It was a chain that was all around the country, and it pioneered selling a lot of cheap stuff at low prices and bringing working class people in to shop, and it also pioneered in exploiting workers around the world that it could buy those products from at cheap things, and people would go down there. You know, that was a basic place where you go to buy your pie plates, your shoelaces, things for sewing, things like that.
And you'd take the streetcar down from the east side and the west side down Woodward Avenue, which the streetcar sold off to Mexico City in the 1950s. You'd meet under the clock at Kern's and then go over to Woolworth's, and it all seemed very, very happy. But tell us about 1937 as well. There was a few things going on. There was certainly an economic and political context in which this all fit.
Well, of course, it seemed very happy, but I think people could see that those women, the women that were working at Woolworth, had an exhausted look in their eye. Well, in 1937 in Detroit was a very massive historic moment. In fact, one of the most important moments in the 20th century, and people from Detroit should be very proud of this. It was way in the depths of the Great Depression, and in the middle of that, that's when the United Auto Workers was formed, and they had a famous sit-down strike that started in December of 1936 and went into early 1937. When they occupied part of a General Motors plant and shut down General Motors in the entire country and had this huge victory that really had massive ripple effects ever since in the labor movement and in people's sense of what was possible. And those auto workers did it because they occupied the plant, one particular plant that was strategically important to the whole production of General Motors. And, you know, I think people know about normal strikes where you have a lot of people outside, you try to get as many people as possible with picket signs, and you try to keep it so that no strike breakers or scabs can get in, and that's how you shut for diamond production or whatever kind of work is going on in that place, and that's how you win. Then people started experimenting with sit-down strikes in the 30s, and General Motors was the most famous one, and they sat down, and because they had public opinion on their side, because the police chief wasn't quite going to beat them up, because the governor was sort of not willing to send in the troops, and people had a sense that, you know, there was something very wrong in U.S. society in the depths of the Great Depression, so they had public opinion on their side. And they won this huge victory over General Motors in February of 1937, and nobody could believe it. It's like beating the biggest corporation in the whole world in the middle of a depression. And because of that, people in Detroit started thinking about, okay, what can we do?
These were, simple. Not only were they, as they were called, counter girls, and probably, what do you think they were making? 25 cents an hour, maybe something like that?
Yeah, I mean, you can do those things, and it doesn't really translate into dollars now. The main thing is it wasn't enough to live on if you weren't already living with your family.
But these were teenagers, right, essentially? 18,
they were mostly some late teenagers, early 20s, and that's why they're called counter girls. But, of course, that was part of thinking of women as children, you know, like calling the 60-year-old secretary a girl. These women, they worked 12, you know, very long hours, very long weeks. They never got to sit down. They were very exhausted. They were deliberately hired with high turnover and treated poorly by management so that they would quit, so they never had to give anybody a raise. It was the same formula that you see, like, at, you know, Target or you know, any of these stores, Walmart. You have a really high turnover, and then you don't ever have to give anybody a raise, and you make it so the job is very, very low skill so that you can just hire anybody off the street. And that formula was pioneered in part by Woolworths in the early 20th century. What's really interesting is that these women decided, they were very regular women. They were 100 young women. And the headline here is that these 100 young women sat down and occupied a Woolworth store, that Woolworth store in downtown Detroit, for an entire week and won all their demands at the end of the week. And also another Woolworth store, and sorry I don't have the location off the top of my head, they also shut down after 4 days. So it's a really amazing story. But it wasn't even just about Woolworth, because there were lots of little so-called quickie sit-downs after the big General Motors strike and before the Woolworth strike. All these workers, like in a golf ball factory, in a place that served lunches, in restaurants, in all sorts of little tiny factories and workplaces in Detroit, people would just sort of sit down for 3 hours and win all their demands, because management was terrified, because they thought, gee, anything could happen here, right? Mm-hmm. So it was this sort of incredible historical moment that's hard to imagine now, but if people think about Occupy Wall Street, you realize that people can get ideas really fast and things can mushroom. And that's what happened at Woolworths.
Way before social media as well. My guest is Dana Frank, and she's a professor of history at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Her account of the 1937 Woolworth sit-down strike has been republished as Women Strikers Occupy Chain Store Win Big, and it's published by Haymarket Books. You go to haymarketbooks.org. You can see it on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. And when every once in a while I'll get email, the subject line will say, "Remember When?" And it'll be this sort of white nostalgia of what Detroit was 50 and 75. 5 years ago, a city that appeared to be, it was predominantly white, and African Americans were really out at the margins of it all. And tell me, in terms of the Woolworth strike in 1937, who these young women were, like, ethnically, and was there any homogeneity to them in terms other than that they were all white?
Well, you know, I've been trying to figure out who these women were. I spent a lot of time on that. From everything I can tell, all those women were white. And that was because Woolworths had very explicit racist hiring practices, not because there weren't black people in Detroit that wanted to and could have done a great job of working there. There was very clearly a lot of discrimination at Woolworths. And, of course, later in the early 1960s, that's when you get the famous sit-downs of the lunch counters at Woolworths all over the South, because Woolworths also refused to serve African-American patrons at its famous lunch counters. So there's a long racial politics of Woolworths stores. As far as we know, these women were all white, although there are stories of light-skinned black women passing for white to work in department stores in this period. But it's really important to understand that Woolworths was really very explicitly a whites-only place, both in terms of working there and in terms of shopping there in the 1930s.
Dana Frank, did you ever find any of these women? I mean, they would probably...
I worked very hard. No, I never found any of them. I tried phone books. I tried everything. I did find, through my mother and the League of Women Voters, kind of where she lives in California, I found a woman who had worked in that store about a few months before, and she told me what it was like to work there, and she worked there when she was 15 or 16. That's the closest I ever came. So anyone had a grandmother out there that worked at Woolworths in 1937, you know, there was a Woolworths strike in laughter that, or earlier than this one in New York City. And if you read Shelley Winters' autobiography, the famous actress Shelley Winters, she actually talks about being a Woolworth striker in her autobiography. But I didn't find that until after the book came out.
You know, that's interesting because particularly when you did the work on this, I assume in the late 1990s, a lot of these women would have who were counter girls then would have been women in their late 70s, and many of them probably are alive today. But you know, when I interviewed you in 2001, you explicitly put out a call asking if anybody remembered the 1937 Woolworth sit-down strike at the Woolworths at the corner of Woodward and Grand River to please get a hold of you, and I'm assuming that
nobody called me. I did, if you look in the text, I mean, I did find two people that visited the picket line, if you look in there.
Mm-hmm.
I did track them down, and they're in the epilogue as well. And then, the story of the research on this is really interesting because we just don't have these kind of stories because you have to have the sources to do it. And one of the reasons that I was able to tell the story with so much detail is because it was so, the media was all over the story. It was on the cover of all the newspapers all over the country, not just in Detroit. And Life magazine, the really famous picture magazine, went down there, and there was a newsreel, which was, you know, before we had YouTube, there were video and television. There were newsreels, movie newsreels would go down there and film it, and that's how I was able to have all those details. And then we also have some autobiographical stuff that was written later by two of the union organizers. So it's we don't take for granted that we even know these stories because they can just disappear and people wouldn't know that these 100 young women, absolutely ordinary young women with no history as far as we can tell of union activity, did this incredibly daring thing. They occupied a store all by themselves for a week and won all their demands. They got a 25% pay raise. They got time and a half for overtime. They got free uniforms, which they'd had to pay for by themselves. And the most amazing thing is they even got paid 50% pay for all the time they'd been occupying the store. Now, that's my idea of a victory.
Well, the old industrial workers of the world, which actually still exist, they say direct action brings you satisfaction. Dana Frank, tell us about this, though, because there's so many little aspects to this. There was a popular song at the time that had one of the lyrics, I met my million-dollar baby at a five-and-ten-cent store. Pick up on that. Tell me what that's
all
about.
Well, people probably may remember the film a few years ago, Million Dollar Baby, where it comes from. And that song, which Bing Crosby made famous, was the Million Dollar Baby was Barbara Hutton, who was the famous Woolworth heiress who had inherited a big chunk of the Woolworth fortune and was famous for being this sort of the super rich girl. In fact, the phrase poor little rich girl was also coined about Barbara Hutton, and she was this symbol of excess wealth during the Depression. She came into her fortune in the early 30s, and she spent it just, you know, 1,000 different expensive cars. She had this wedding with just the most spectacular display of obscene wealth you can imagine, and it was all over the newspapers during the 1930s. She actually eventually married royalty like 5 times, and I mean, she's a sort of famous splay your money around rich figure, and who was obviously kind of messed up psychologically too because she needed to do it. She was a symbol of this kind of absolutely out of control excess wealth in the 1930s, and she was the Woolworth fortune heiress. So she was contrasted in the public imagination to these tired young white women working in the stores who were exhausted and exploited by Woolworths. And, of course, she was rich because they were poor. That's where her wealth came from the exploitation of those women, as well as from the exploitation of the people that were making the products that were sold at Woolworths. So the song goes, I met a million-dollar baby in a 5-and-10-cent store. So the 5-and-10-cent store is the Woolworths, and the million-dollar baby in this is Barbara Hutton. And so that contrast was embedded in the popular imagination long before the Woolworth strike, which was part of why the Woolworth strikers got so much public sympathy, which was part of why they could pull it off. So, you know, we hear the phrase million-dollar baby. We don't even realize that it goes back to these Woolworth strikers.
Absolutely incredible. Dana Frank is my guest. She's written Women Strikers Occupy Chain Store Win Big. It's the story of the Detroit 1937 Woolworth sit-down, and it's available from Haymarket Books, Haymarket AmericanBooks.org. I'm Peter Werby. Thank you all for joining me. And there's so many other aspects, and let's pick up on some of the other themes that you mentioned. At the beginning of this, you were comparing Woolworths to firms like Walmart and Target and what have you. Could you give us just a quick sketch of Woolworth? Because I said in sort of the iconography, if you will, of nostalgia for what Detroit was, you know, Woolworth is just this wonderful place where you could go get a soda and then, as you said, go get some shoelaces for a nickel. So its image is extraordinarily positive in the common memory for the people who have a memory of it.
Well, first of all, we have to remember that is a common memory for white people, and black people for it was very painful because they couldn't go in there and they couldn't work there. So it had a very deep symbolic meaning. Now, this is not just about Detroit. Woolworths was all over the country, and it was segregated in the South, and black people weren't hired in the North even. So, you know, it's important to say who's the we that even remembers it with nostalgia. But certainly it was like the classic, you know, we think of it as like, gee, the hokey old-time nostalgic store, when actually in the 20s and 30s, Woolworth was the modernizer. Woolworth was the chain store bulldozer like Walmart or Costco destroying small businesses. And, you know, Woolworth was the one that pioneered economies of scale where you buy things in bulk and then you're able to sell them at low prices. But it also destroyed a lot of small businesses. So it's sort of this general, you know, in 20 years, is it all going to be nostalgia for Walmart? So something even more evil and enormous will come along. But what's interesting is there was also a movement against these chain stores, and it wasn't just Woolworth. Woolworth was the biggest one, but there were also supermarket chains that were taking out small grocery stores as well in the neighborhoods. There was actually a whole movement in the 30s against what was known as the chain store evil. I love that phrase, the chain store evil. And there was even a law against that was passed in Congress called the Robinson-Patman Act against chain stores that was little unconstitutional, but it's sort of Woolworths, which we think of as the romantic, nice old thing, was actually the sort of bulldozing modernizer destroying other small businesses.
Now, also, you mentioned sort of a parallel between the 1937 Woolworths sit-down strike in Detroit, where the counter girls, the young women there, actually won after a sit-in, sit-down strike. Let me get a parenthesis in here. You know, it was called, in that era, the sit-down strike, right? And people remained made famous, of course, by the UAW workers who sat down in the General Motors plant. But, and as you said, there were literally hundreds, if not thousands, of sit-down strikes in the late 1930s. I'm kind of weaving too far around. I can't remember what the sentence of the parenthesis was. But you were mentioning the parallel between the Occupy movement and the sit-down strikes that just sort of swept. I guess that's where I was going. Swept the nation.
Well, you know, it's like there's some parallels here and there's some distinctions. You know, a sit-down strike isn't about let's take this over and own this. Let's seize this. It's really about a tactic as part of a strike by workers in a particular workplace. And that's what it was, as opposed to a strike where you would be outside the place of employment and picketing and keeping out the scabs, the strike breakers. So, you know, it's a very particular tactic used by workers to get even more power under the right circumstances, because, of course, you can get in a lot of trouble because you are occupying private property. So it depends on public opinion and on the role of the police and local government of what's going to happen. The Occupy movement has a lot of parallels. I mean, it is about this kind of spreading like wildfire, ordinary people just sitting down and occupying something. I mean, the Occupy movement is about occupying public space or sometimes privatized public space in the case of New York and saying we're just going to sit here, we're going to use our bodies, and we're going to challenge the larger distribution of wealth and the larger politics of our society in this sort of mass movement that spreads quickly. So it is about occupying a space. It's about people using their bodies. The demands are different, but there's a really big similarity between 1937 in Detroit and what's been happening with Occupy Wall Street, in that you suddenly have a historic moment where people are outraged about gaps between rich and poor. They're outraged that in a time of economic downturn, people are getting richer and richer. They're outraged at people losing their jobs. They're outraged at the lack of response by the government. And so they have this outrage that they're putting into their Occupy thing. But also they have a sense of daring because they also understand that because of that moment, that public opinion is on their side and they can do things that wouldn't otherwise be possible. But in the case of these Woolworth suckers, they're not actually trying to seize anything. They're using it as a tactic, saying, we're not going to get out of here until you actually recognize our union and meet some of our demands.
What came out of the late 30s sit-down movement, though, was a permanent institution of an apparatus that defended worker standards of living for ordinary working people and what have you. So far, the Occupy movement has been, although it still exists here in Detroit, it's pretty much been dispersed from public view.
Well, you know, as a historian, I think that dispersal goes into other channels. I think we don't really know what's going to happen next. It could erupt tomorrow into something spectacular, or those people are learning lessons and taking it into other forms. In the case of the 1930s, both in the case of auto workers and in course of retail clerks, they went on to do all kinds of huge organizing and build these big labor organizations that for decades and decades up to this day run all kinds of institutionalized gains for working peoples, including, you know, vacations with pay, health insurance, not just wages. And I think Occupy has had different goals, and I think they're working through how do you actually get power, and also how do you not just be co-opted into somebody just sort of getting elected and then selling out your demands. So I think that Occupy is even more experimental, and also Occupy has been, through democratic processes, trying to think about how do you connect the dots of a lot of different issues, whereas the General Motors and Woolworth strikes were very focused, which gave them power, but they weren't taking on as much as the Occupy movement is.
I mentioned earlier that Dana Frank's pamphlet, Women Strikers Occupy Chain Store Win Big, about the Detroit 1937 Woolworth sit-down strike, was part of a Haymarket Books, a pamphlet series. You can go to haymarketbooks.org. Also have another one by the incredible essayist Mike Davis, Be Realistic, Demand the Impossible. That's a slogan from Paris, 1968. And also Francis Fox Piven's Lessons for Our Struggle. Piven, identified as the arch enemy by Glenn Beck, so that makes it worth reading for me just for that. But we just have a minute or so left with Dana Frank, and it's a wonderful pamphlet because on the cover are six young women, the counter girls, if you will, at Woolworth's, and they just all have these smiles. There are grandmothers, maybe in some cases our great-grandmothers' age, and yet it didn't have a happy ending, did it?
Well, they themselves lost their contract after 6 months, but it depends on how you define a happy ending, because that strike led to contracts by retail clerks in all the big department stores all over the country that are still there to this day. So again, sometimes the particular people that do something aren't the one that immediately benefit it, but it's part of a larger building of the labor movement in stores and also in all kinds of workplaces in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and up to this day. So they were part of that giant, the ripple effects of successes that did lead to contract all through in all Woolworth stores. There were like 40 Woolworth stores in New York City, for example, got a contract and kept the contract for a long time. So it doesn't. They themselves did not keep that contract at more than 6 months, but that doesn't mean that it didn't have huge and positive ripple effects. And also, I do want to say we haven't had a chance to talk about the fact that these were women, and the media treated them like they were just silly girls playing strike, and they kept calling them girls instead of women. I mean, some of them were girls, but they kept sort of seeing that they were just in here playing strike, and they were doing nothing but thinking about their boyfriends, and when actually they were very smart, they were very savvy, they knew what they were doing, and they were very brave, and they did something that almost nobody had ever done, and it was a huge victory. And it's really important to claim these women's militants, especially in the face that everyone wanted to treat them like silly girls playing strike, although in some ways they were so smart, they knew how to use that to protect themselves, because if they were just silly girls playing strike, it would look really bad if the police came in and pulled them out by their hair.
And the one name that I remember from the restaurant workers.
Hotel and restaurant employees.
Was Myra Wolfgang, one of Detroit's great labor leaders. But she comes along a little after this.
Well, she came in like, you know, the second day of the strike after the women themselves went out on strike. Her name was Mira Komorowski at the time. And she was really like a very driving force in this strike. But then she and the women, for that matter, to a certain extent, got pushed aside by male leaders from the cooks union and the retail clerks who had decided that they knew how to run the show. And this is tricky because the women who went out on strike, they needed that help. They needed that solidarity from people with more experience in the labor movement. One of the bad sides of the story is that those rank-and-file women also lost control over the negotiating process by the end. So, you know, it just brings up this theme of union democracy. If we're going to build these movements, we always have to pay attention to democratic practices, and we also have to pay attention to the gender politics and racial politics of that.
Absolutely incredible story, and not only is it just a story worth reading in and of itself, it has a lot to tell us about what we're doing today. The pamphlet is Women Strikers Occupy Chain Store Win Big. It's the story of the 1937 Detroit Woolworth sit-down strike. I was just down there thinking about this. Woodward and Grand River in downtown Detroit. My guest has been Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and you can find all this at haymarketbooks.org. You can go to my website as well, peterwerby.com. Dana Frank, thanks for being on my show.
Thanks so much, and thanks for bringing back the story.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
But
are back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, we hear a lot about inequality these days. The 1% that rule us, the rest of us, 99% getting screwed, all that. And yet it wasn't always like this, you know? Probably the majority of time that humans were on the earth, that societies were in a relative state of equality. But as inequality began to develop, the political state was invented to, guess what? Enforce inequality. That's right. And most political states have been pretty tyrannical, right? In terms of defending the guys, always the guys at the top. But we're living in a new world, 21st century, and we hear a lot about inequality and what to make of it. There's a lot of rationalizations for it, or a lot of, let's say, rationales for it in some people's mind. There's rich countries and poor countries, rich regions, poor regions, and a lot of it just seems natural, you know, like bad weather. I mean, that's the way it goes. If you're one side of the border, you're in the U.S. and doing great. If you're on the other side, you're in Mexico and you're not doing so good. Well, let's see if we can get a handle on this. There is a great series called The No-Nonsense Guides, and it goes A to, well, at least A to S. No, A to W, I see. And things like the No-Nonsense Guides, the Armed Trade, Climate Change, Conflict and Peace, Democracy, Global Media, World Health, a lot of stuff like this. Well, I wanted to do this one particularly because I think it's pretty relevant to what's going on in our world. And that's the No-Nonsense Guide to Equality. Its author is Danny Dorling. It's D-O-R-L-I-N-G. And Danny Dorling is a professor of human geography at the University of Sheffield in the U.K. He's written a lot about the widening gap between rich and poor, and his work regularly appears in The Guardian UK. He's the author of several books, including Injustice, Why Social Inequality Persists, and also The Atlas of the Real World. It's a pleasure to welcome Professor Danny Dorling. Danny, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you're in Sheffield, are you, right now?
Yeah, in Sheffield, right in the middle of the UK, right in the middle of England.
Well, that's good. So this is the No-Nonsense Guide to Equality. And maybe before we started, you said people often think it's inequality. Why is the confusion here? Why do you think people, the word equality, we hardly hear that anymore?
No, people are always talking about inequality and how the gap's getting bigger. And they don't talk about the opposite. They don't talk about what happens if the gap gets smaller, the times when it got smaller, and when we become a bit more equal. And the word equality isn't used because people often think you mean perfect equality, everybody having exactly the same. But when we talk about inequality, we don't mean that. When we talk about inequality, it's not about one person having everything, everybody else having nothing. But the word equality is all about becoming a bit more equal, and what's good when that happens to you.
Well, this used to be kind of taken for granted up till maybe the 17th century, and when we ceased to be subjects of royalty and became citizens in the West, in England, France, the United States, we had our revolutions.
Oh, we stayed subjects in England, I'm afraid, but yeah, almost everybody else.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You guys are subjects, aren't you?
Well, we were. We became citizens by accident about 20 years ago when a minister signed something in Europe. But yeah, we're all citizens now, but you're correct. Go on.
So the point being that there was suddenly there was this like huge change in the conception of how people relate to one another. There wasn't people didn't take it for granted anymore that there should be this rich ruling class and then this mass of peasants. So there was a drive towards sort of leveling the field in greater. I mean, there's greater efforts at different times. I mean, some of the socialist and communist revolutions took a whack at it. Give us sort of a broad historic spread of when how this came, equality and inequality even came as a concept.
Okay. Well. You can go way, way back. I mean, for most of human life, people have lived in small groups and been pretty equal. We became more unequal with cities and with farming, but at various times, those states which were particularly unequal fell apart. It's not very sustainable. Inequality really rose with the Industrial Revolution, at least in places like Europe. But around that same time, one of the most equal places in the rich world was the United States of America. 150 years ago, the USA was about the most equal of all the rich countries in the world. And after that, inequalities tended to increase. They increased it up to a kind of maximum around about 1912, as the people with most got more. And then with the First World War, and then with the crash in 1929 and the Depression in the 30s, we started to become more equal again. People started demanding their rights again, and equality grew in the United States, United Kingdom, right across Europe, all the way through the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. It's only really been in the last 30 years, 40 years, that we've become unequal again. So there's a very checkered history of this. We haven't always been as we are now. Currently, we have inequalities at very high levels, but that isn't normal. It's not normal for most rich countries in the world at the moment, and it's not normal for the history of the United States and the United Kingdom.
Well, Danny, darling, I don't know whether this is a phrase that's used in the United Kingdom as well. It very well may be, but this is pretty common to everyone. You say the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. So, I mean, that concept is sort of, you know, emblazoned on our consciousness, right? So it's not unusual that this is occurring.
Well, it's been happening in the USA all the way since the late 1970s. The problem is people then think that's been happening forever, and they don't realize that before the late 1970s, those inequalities were decreasing. Families were becoming more similar to each other. The people at the bottom were getting most. The people at the top weren't losing out. The people at the top were not becoming poorer, but they weren't getting more and more and more as compared to the average. And so society was coming together. And those kind of, you know, apple pie kind of pictures of 1950s, 1960s USA partly were about the fact that the differences were narrowing. There were, of course, you know, significant differences. Civil rights were still having to be fought for. But people were coming together as compared to their grandparents. Their chances in life were getting better. They could look forward to the future. Their children would have a better life than they had. That's all part of our history. And it also happens to be the current reality for countries like Switzerland or the Netherlands, where the richest 1% have never had less than they currently have in places like Switzerland and the Netherlands. And these are not radical countries. They're not run by socialist governments. There's a huge amount of misconception about the richest 1% in the UK and the USA, the idea that it's inevitable that they get richer. It's inevitable they have this much. We just don't look back at our own past and see it wasn't the case when I was a child, and we don't look at other countries where it isn't the case right now.
The book is The No-Nonsense Guide to Equality. My guest is, pardon me, Danny Dorling. He's the author. It's published by the New Internationalist. You can go to nononsenseguides.org and pick up on this one and also a whole series in there. You're listening to The Peter Werbe Show. There'll be a link to this on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com as well. Well, you mentioned that the word equality is sort of out of fashion because it suggests like socialism or something like that or worse, you know. And yet another word or another phrase we don't use is redistribution of income. Yet there is always a fixed amount of wealth at any given moment in a society, and it's all about how it's distributed. So if workers are going on strike and they're saying we want a dollar an hour more from the bosses, that and they get it. That's the bosses have a dollar an hour less for every worker, and the workers have a dollar an hour more. So that's a redistribution of income.
Yes.
So talk about that a little, about the distribution of income and
okay. Well, in those countries with strong trade unions, they tend to have managed to keep wages high. For most people, and the share that's taken by the top 1% has been much less. What also often happens in those countries is because wages for most people are higher, they've got spare money to spend, real money to spend, and they buy things which keep the companies going that their employers are running. You're in Detroit. A problem in Detroit is that if you begin to reduce wages of those people who are working in Detroit, they're less able to buy things that are made in the United States of America, and then you get fewer things being made in the United States of America by the people who were being employed but at wages that are too low to form that demand. So you can get a kind of vicious circle when people at the top take too much. But people at the bottom have to work together and fight to get their share. Often people at the top are not clever enough to realize that by being so selfish, they're going to make everybody's life worse, including their own. It's not great to be rich in a country which is very, very unequal. You have much higher levels of violent crime. You have a kind of social disharmony where there are large parts of the country and your cities that you feel you can't live in. You begin to get scared about where your children go to school, even if you're doing quite well economically at the top of society. You always feel you need to be paid more because you need to live in a better school district area, a better neighborhood where it's safe. So inequality is actually quite bad for people at the top of society, as well as being very, very bad for people at the bottom of society.
Well, Danny Dorling, I don't know if you can answer this. You're a professor of human geography at the University of Sheffield in England, but I often ask this of guests when we talk about this. I wonder why these people at the top want so much money and fight for it to the point where they will fund politicians who will make them even more. The current CEO of Apple, Timothy yes. Cook, his compensation for last year was $378 million.
Yeah.
this, you know, I think most of us would be happy with another 10 grand a year, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. This I can't even begin to guess why.
How do you get to this situation?
Yeah.
Well, we got to it before in a gilded age. We've been here before, this age of mass stupidity, particularly at the top. So we know that it can happen. We also know that in other countries, I mentioned the Netherlands earlier, the boss of Royal Dutch Shell, one of the richest paid men in the Netherlands, said a few years ago, if you paid me twice as much, I wouldn't have worked any harder, and if you paid me half as much, I wouldn't have worked any less. So people at the top in other rich countries are not quite as selfish and don't take quite as much as in the UK and USA. What happens in these countries is that the elite, in a sense, have got out of control. They begin to think that their salary and their bonuses is a reflection of how good they are. That is, you know, what a good job they're doing. And as soon as you get into this terrible state of mind of thinking that you're only as good as how much you're paid, and you also promote men, it's almost always men, who are really self-obsessed about their own status to the top, you're in a vicious circle, and what happens is you get a bubble economy. Eventually, these kind of masters at universe at the very top end up taking too much, get fired out, and it's happening in Britain at the moment. People that are at the very top are being sacked, and it may be the beginnings of time of change. In the same way as when this last got out of control in the 1920s, late 1920s, we began to see that sign of change. But we don't know. We're in a very unstable situation. What we do know is that you can't pay single individuals that many millions of dollars at the top and carry on for very long doing that.
Yeah, and it doesn't have any accelerator value to it. It's just parked. It's this digital wealth. It's not even like, in some ways, it doesn't even exist. And you have in Detroit now, they're announcing they're going to have 61 kids in a class. The suburb I live in is $6 million short of a $14 million, or I can't, it's, anyway, a pittance, yeah. Something that these guys carry in their front pocket if they carry any money at all. So,
but the problem is, it really is real money. It is real money. You could take that money, and just a fraction of it could improve the lives of hundreds of thousands of people in Detroit.
Yeah,
it really is real money.
What I meant, excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt, yeah. But what I meant was, it's not real when they have it. They have it. It's just this cyber wealth that is.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
But they can't possibly enjoy it. They cannot. You cannot do something with that money. Yeah, there isn't a holiday you can have that would cost that much. Yeah, there isn't a boat. There isn't a yacht.
Yeah,
and even when you get your giant yacht, you know, what on earth do you do sitting on it, the tiny little you, on this huge boat?
The book is No Nonsense Guide to Equality. My guest is Danny Dorling. You listen to the Peter Werby Show. The book makes clear the social consequences of inequality. And one of the things that I think you try to do in this is not just put it on sort of a, what would you say, you know, and I say this in the best spirit, a bleeding heart. I mean, if you think about the iconography of a bleeding heart, that's pretty serious good stuff, to at least Christians. So actually the consequences, and you said some of it, you noted some of it, even the wealthy wind up having to live a life of risk, of gaining communities, of bodyguards, and you know, fear about their children. Overall, what's the effect on the rest of us, the 99%, particularly? Well, and I was going to say the lower echelons, but everybody. Why is inequality bad for us?
Well, we all slowly become the lower echelons. That's why it's bad for us. You know, you may think you're in the middle, but as inequality rises, as you become less equal, you find you're no longer in the middle, or the middle is at the bottom. So there's this sense of falling down. All the time, as inequality rises, the people above you are moving further apart. You're moving down, and you don't look down because it looks scary down there. You get this heightened sense of anxiety and depression. Very poor mental health. The most unequal of rich countries in the world had the poor mental health. Life expectancy is harmed. Infant mortality is higher in the more unequal countries. Rates of violence are higher because people begin to get angry and are much more likely to fight each other, much more likely to kill each other at the extremes. You have the highest prison populations and the highest number of violent crimes in those most unequal countries, and in the more equal countries, the prisons are almost empty. You can walk through to some of the most equal countries in the world and really not expect to be a victim of crime at all, because crime is so rare.
What countries?
Japan is a classic example at the moment. For a British tourist in Japan, the Foreign Office, which is the part of government which gives us advice, says the most likely bad thing to happen to you in Japan is that you lose your passport because you put it down somewhere and forget to pick it up. Not being mugged, no other crime. I was recently in Japan, and I asked my Japanese colleagues if they could tell me where the very poorest neighborhood was in Japan. They told me where it was. It was in Osaka. And I said, could they take me there? Because I'm a geographer and I like to see different areas. And they said there was no need for them to take me there. I could go there on my own. I thought, this is strange. I would never send a Japanese social scientist to one of the poorest parts of Britain and expect them to be okay. But anyway, I went.
Same
I
here.
On a train.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't do it in the US. I got on a train. I got on another train. I came out at the station and I walked. And I walked into this very poor neighborhood in Japan. And you could see people were poor. But we knew it was poor because there was a small fence around the police station. They don't have fences around their police stations in Japan. It was about 5 feet high. And that was because there'd been a tiny riot there once. I had a look at the bikes. There were lots of bikes around, and half the bikes were unlocked. And I felt, it was daytime, I felt completely safe. It's just remarkably different. And part of the reason why you're safe in somewhere like Japan, even in the poorest parts of Japan, is that Japan is a much more equal country. The people at the very bottom are paid twice as much in real terms compared to somewhere like the UK or the USA. The people at the top take much, much less. There's a much greater sense of cohesion in a country like that. And when you have that sense of cohesion, it's simply not worth committing crime. So crime still happens, but it's so rare that you can send a tourist on their own to the poorest part of a country. And you then know you've got a country that's working well when you can do that.
Well, talk to us a little about the structural nature of inequality, and you talk about that in the No Nonsense Guide to Equality. And that is, I would think that most people think, as I said way back when I introduced you, that it's sort of like bad weather. You know, you're going to have a picnic and it rains. There's nothing much you can do about it. Well, you know, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. I'm just a solitary individual, and I guess that's what happened. Why does this happen? Why is there such great amount of inequality, and why is it growing?
This is one of the hardest questions about why are there such differences between these countries, and why have some countries have a trend of increasing equality, and some have a trend of decreasing equality. Bad news is that. One of the ways it's easiest to become more equal is to do something like lose a war. Countries which have lost a war tend to become much more equal, or can even have equality imposed upon them. One of the reasons why Japan is so equal is that the United States government imposed equality on Japan. It took the land away from the aristocracy after the Second World War because it was afraid of a communist revolution occurring. So Japan now has a 90-95% middle class because of what the United States did after the war to Japanese society. Things other than that also have an effect. The big changes happened in the UK and the USA and in much of Western Europe in the 1970s during the oil crisis and the economic crises then. And at that point, different political parties, different movements, different trade unionists in different countries reacted in different ways. They reacted in such a way in the UK and the USA that we began to become increasingly unequal. There was more solidarity in other countries. there were these key tipping points. There was a tipping point earlier around the 1929 crash, a tipping point in the 1970s. We may be at a tipping point now. And it is at these tipping points, in these long, steady changes in social equality and inequality, that people have the most chance of making a difference, that your vote matters the most, that a particular president can actually have an influence. Whereas, to be honest, most presidents don't have much of an influence on this trend. And there are points when it really does matter as an individual, where groups can do something. And the kind of good news is, things have got so bad, we may be at one of those points again. Levels of inequality have got as high as they last were when we became more equal. But the bad news is that history doesn't necessarily repeat itself. One of the things which happened way back then, at the very start of the 1920s, was that there had been a revolution in Russia. And a revolution in Russia caused fear amongst people at the top of society, in the UK and the USA, such that people at the very top of society joined in the movement for more equality because they didn't want to see violence and revolution happening in their countries. Now, that isn't the situation today. And that makes it harder to make things more equal today because you do not have a group of people at the top of the society saying, if we carry on the way we are, we really could see violence spreading that will affect us personally.
Yeah, and
so it's going to be harder this time around.
There's... talk of raising the income tax on the very wealthy, like 2% or something, where and the right wing calls that class warfare, whereas a lot of people, some people like myself, say that there ought to be, as long as we have such poverty, as long as the infrastructure of the country is so threatened, that we ought to be talking about over $5 million income. That ought to be like a 95% tax on wealth over that. So old Timothy Cook from Apple would wind up with about, instead of $378 million, he'd wind up with about, the poor boy, what a commie I am, huh? Would wind up with only about $6 million.
Well, it changes. I mean, my preference is to actually have a society where you just pay people at the top less in the first place.
Yeah.
Because paying people a lot and then taxing them tends to cause resentment. So that's partly how Japan does it so well. It just doesn't pay so much at the top, which gives you more money to employ more people at the bottom. Because the number of people that Apple cannot employ who will not be creating the thing which will mean that Apple will exist in 30 years' time is enormous. Look at how many young graduates from universities Apple could employ for half of his salary. When Apple doesn't exist, when it's gone the way of so many of these other tech companies in 30 years' time, that'll be because he was too greedy. When it comes to calling people a commie and taxes, in other countries it's different. In some countries, part of what it means to be free is to be more equal. You can't be free. You can't have freedom if a few people have so much money. In France, the newly elected president has declared it people's patriotic duty to pay 75% tax on incomes of over €1 million. And you're lucky to be able to pay that. You're lucky to live in a society which is so well organized as the French society, where people live much longer, have better mental health than the USA, that you get to pay 75% tax if you're rich. And it's a privilege to be able to pay that. Now, that kind of language in Detroit will just sound so alien. But what you have to think is just how alien does the language from the United States sound to most people in Western Europe, when they hear of people saying it's okay for people to have as much as they want at the top, it's people's fault at the bottom if they haven't managed to also be as greedy as those at the top.
Well, we are out of time, and the book is The No-Nonsense Guide to Equality. My guest has been Danny Dorling. He's a professor of human geography at the University of Sheffield in England. We're talking to him there, and it's part of a whole series called The No-Nonsense Guides. So it's the nononsenseguides.org. It's quite extensive. And if you want to get a handle on what is happening in our country and our individual lives, our cities, why are cities going bankrupt? Why, why do people have these jillion-dollar salaries and other people are going bankrupt because of medical expenses? This is a great place to start. The No Nonsense Guide to Equality. Danny Dorling, thanks for being on my show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
Do you need cash right now for any reason? Then you need Matt's Jewelry Brokers. At Matt's, they pay top dollar for your used or broken gold, silver, and platinum jewelry. Class rings, belt buckles, coins, flatware, and more. It's really that easy. Stop into one of Matt's five locations with your items and walk out with cold, hard cash.
Hi, I'm Matt. We've been family-owned and operated for 30 years and pride ourselves on honesty, integrity, and paying more than the superstores do for your broken or used items just lying around the house. If it's collecting dust, we'll buy it. If it's broken, we'll buy it. If you don't want it, we'll buy it. So before you go anywhere else, stop by one of my five locations. In Macomb at 21 Mile and Romeo Plank, in Troy at Square Lake and Rochester Road, or my pawn shop in Southfield at 10 Mile and Greenfield. We're also in the Meyer in Clinton Township and Lennox. Check us out online at MattsJewelryBrokers.com or call us at 586-286-2866. That's 586-286-2866. When you need cash fast, go to Matt's.
Back to the Rock.
Got the message?
On the Riff.
12 years old, and two more should be a whore. Nobody ever told her it's the wrong way. Don't be afraid of the quickness you get laid. For your family get paid, it's the wrong way. I give her all that I have to give. I'm gonna make it hard to live. Salty tears running down.
Guitar.